Well, good morning, everybody. John Hanson and, well, everyone knows Esmeralda.
Yeah.
You just did the traffic report there, Esmeralda.
I did. Watching the roads.
Watching those
and
roads.
The phones.
Here we are. We're filling in for Nick DiGilio. And a happy Independence Day to everybody out there. Good Tuesday morning. We're going to be with you till 5 a.m. this morning. Mm-hmm. By the way, Esmeralda, that was my favorite way ever to start a traffic report. We were, because Esmeralda's down here now, we were still eating pizza. We were still doing
All right, and Shannon, so I go, everyone shut up.
Everybody shut up right before the traffic started. I think that's, I think you should just do that on the air. Before every, as the traffic report starts. So Vic tosses to you.
And I go.
And then you go, everybody shut up. This is important.
Listen up. I got something to say. So, the Edens is clear.
Yeah, it doesn't really quite work at 2 in the morning. Maybe about 4:30 as that construction's getting cleared out.
Okay, maybe.
Everybody shut up.
Shut up.
All lanes open on the Kennedy. Esmeralda, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I you were on with Mike Heidemann on Sunday morning.
As he dumped himself, the JV John Hanson.
Well, that's very kind of Michael Heidemann to say. He's a lot prettier than I am. I will give him that much. But no, it's Independence Day. It's the 4th of July, and we're going to get to some Independence Day stuff in the 3 a.m. hour. We got a historian coming in to kind of tell us the history of the Declaration of Independence, which, God, that sentence sounded so boring, but I promise you it is not. It's a...
Yeah,
it's
but you're pumped.
I'm really excited. I love diving into, you know, we think of these figures, Adams and Washington and Jefferson as these marble statues that we have them as now. But they were living, breathing men with flaws, with desires, with families, and it's really fascinating to hear the story of how this all came about, because we kind of take this stuff for granted now, our independence. But believe it or not, saying that one group of people wanted independence from a tyrannical government as they saw it, or any sort of monarchy, that was the first time someone had done that. People had overthrown governments before, replaced one king with another king, but no one really had ever made the notion of governing themselves. So anyways, as you can tell, I'm excited about that. So we're going to talk to the historian. I heard you yesterday on my drive up for the morning show at WCIU. You guys were talking about 4th of July facts, and I freaked out, but it was
we just had a couple.
No, yeah. It was
we barely scratched the surface.
Exactly. So it was a good primer for everybody. By the way, this is a conversation, of course, with everybody out there, too, 312-981-7200. As we do celebrate Independence Day, it's not a holiday that has kind of the, as many, I think, traditions wrapped around it as, say, like a Thanksgiving or Christmas. But I imagine there's things out there, Patty went to Lake Geneva every year, that maybe that everyone did on Independence Day as kids growing up. Maybe you've continued that tradition with your kids or your grandkids. Besides just so well, we watch the fireworks in town, although that's a great tradition to do. We'd love to hear about what you guys did with your families growing up. Or currently.
What you're going to do,
Or what you're going to do today. I got to say, I have been out of town, I think, the last few 4th of Julys, because my neighborhood, the West Ukrainian Village, East Humboldt Park neighborhood, is like a war zone tonight.
Yeah, no, even when I was walking
That's crazy.
Over to the train, which was about 8:30 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, you could hear it like, pew, 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 pew.
Oh, it's insane. Mm-hmm. And people, I mean, it's got to be the M80s that people are launching off.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of those. I don't get
those
it. They just make noise, and then that's that.
And I'm all about everybody having fun. I really don't have a problem, even though we had to wake up early, and, you know, I wake up early. It doesn't really bother me all that much. But Patty brought up a good point as she was leaving about a lot of folks have PTSD that might have issues. Of course, the dogs and the cats, that's a thing. But it's just one of those things when you live in the city, and it's the 4th of July, I guess you know it's coming.
Yeah, it's what happens.
It's a holiday that's literally the date, so it's marked on the calendar.
Pretty
clearly.
And people like to celebrate 2 weeks in advance with their fireworks.
Well, and also my neighborhood, especially the East Humboldt Park area, there's a lot of Puerto Ricans that live in the neighborhood, and they celebrate the Puerto Rican Day Festival.
Independence?
Yeah, that's like in the middle of June. Mm-hmm. So usually it just goes from June through.
Going.
It just keeps on going, but it has amped up tonight. This morning, I should say, and I imagine it will tonight as well. So 312-981, you can also text us, 312-981-7200. So Esmeralda, I guess you'll get the ball rolling. Did you guys celebrate the 4th of July growing up?
We did. You know, we usually did the old cook some meat on the grill.
The old meat cooking?
Old meat cooking day.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we would have people over, and we would, you know, cook up some hamburgers, hot dogs, that whole thing. And then my mom would tell me this story when I was little, like very little. I was frightened to death of the fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
And,
really?
Yeah, and the, like one of the first times they showed me fireworks, I was like, ah, no, and I like freaked out. But I like them. I mean, after
was it the noises of them? Was it?
I don't know. I mean, you're a little kid and you just see big lights in the sky.
Right.
It could probably be, and then like a shooting noise. It's probably a bit intimidating.
Oh, for sure. So you just did a meat day.
Meat. Yeah, we weren't. You know, there really wasn't. Yeah, we would just take it as a hey, it's like hang out with friends and.
Were your parents
chill.
Born in the United States or did
no.
they? Okay.
No, my mom's from Mexico and my dad's from Guatemala.
Okay. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I imagine it's a lot different for people that aren't, I don't know. I imagine it takes on different connotations because some people love their independence here in the United States. Some people...
It's more of just a day.
Right.
A day of like, let's hang out, let's grill and all that jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents aren't too like holiday people.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go all out for things anyway.
Yeah.
So they like to keep it low-key.
Except for tamale making.
Except
for that.
Well, eating, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, growing up, the 4th of July was actually kind of a big holiday for us. My parents used that holiday as a reunion with their college friends.
They would
do that we'd always do this on New Year's Eve and the 4th of July. They'd get together with the college friends, three couples, and all their kids. We'd either have grill outs in the backyard, but for many years, the taste of Chicago kind of centered around the 4th of July. It would start before, like, the 1st and go to the 9th. Now it's afterwards. But the fireworks in Chicago, I'm sure everyone remembers listening, used to be on the 3rd of July, at least when I was growing up in the
90s. Yeah, I remember that, too.
It was the night before. So I remember we would come to Chicago, and my parents would rent a hotel room, actually. So it was, like, a big deal, right? They'd pack, like, 12 of us into the hotel room. But it was incredibly packed and full, but we would go watch the fireworks at Navy Pier, and then we'd go to the Taste of Chicago and stuff. And
that's
then
fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, my parents are lame. They don't like crowds.
Yeah, I don't really either. I
they
certainly
hate
wouldn't
people like me.
Mm-hmm.
But I like Taste of Chicago, and actually, yeah, that's happening 5th through the 9th.
Yeah, that starts tomorrow. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it used to start a little bit earlier. Okay, so 312-981-7200. We'd love to hear all of your 4th of July traditions and a whole lot more. You know, the one story that Cassara printed out for us that I forgot that we wanted to talk about was the 5 worst things that people do on planes. I know a lot of people,
people
might be
traveling. Yeah.
So that I absolutely want to talk about.
Heads up, guys.
So yeah, so let's get that conversation started too. So 312-981-7200. Text or call in the worst thing you've ever seen someone do on a plane. Okay, quick breaks. Well, don't get too graphic about it. 720 WGN. We'll be back right after this. Right. 720 WGN. John Hansen and the wonderful dancer, beautiful lady, Miss Esmeralda Leon.
Well-spoken English.
Yeah, that was interesting. Someone wanted to call and let Esmeralda know that her English was very good.
Yeah. Well, you know.
It is.
School.
It is clear. School did it.
School's good.
That's a good. Give a shout-out to your school.
Thanks.
Who taught you your English?
Troy. Troy Community.
Is that the name of a guy?
Consolidated.
Oh. I didn't know some guy that some dude named Troy came over and taught you your English.
It was the Troy Consolidated School System or whatever it was called. There's a bunch of different ones.
There you go, Esmeralda.
They taught me.
608, by the way, we're talking about 5 worst things that you've seen people do on planes, or the worst thing that you've ever seen someone do. Yeah, traveling is a stressful thing. I take flights, I don't know, once or twice a year, not too often when I go on vacation. But man, around the holidays I hear, and I usually don't go around the holidays, because we're usually working, we're filling in for people here.
Working, and I feel like we're a little smarter.
Poorer? Okay.
I'm just like, I don't want to do. I know there's going to be a million people in
the
airport.
And that's the thing. A lot of people that don't normally fly are flying this time of year. And that's when you get some interesting things. Like this one, 608 says, this is Dave from Monroe, Wisconsin, by the way, saying, trimming nose hairs.
I believe it,
too. How would someone do that?
What do you mean, with little scissors?
No, I know how someone does it. I'm wondering why the heck someone would think that that's okay to do on an airplane.
Because they were late.
Late for what? Do it in the bathroom
plane.
When you land. Like, I don't get that.
They have to get to them right away.
Why is that the moment? At 30,000 feet, moving at 590 knots through the air.
Right?
Is that where you're like, you know what? I need to trim my nose hairs.
I will say, earlier I was on the train, the CTA, and someone was trimming their fingernails. I'm just like, why now? Why?
Where did it go? Did they have like a baggie for them?
No, of course not. The floor.
That is disgusting.
I know, right?
What is wrong with people?
I don't know.
I've never seen something quite like that.
It was far from me. It was like on the other side of the car, but still.
77, doesn't matter. 773 says, I had a woman sitting next to me on the plane that took her shoes off. She was barefoot and her feet smelled.
See, I can't deal with that.
That's
and
a common one.
I like taking my shoes off,
mm-hmm.
but I'm, no, just wear flip-flops.
SmartTraveler.com had an article about the worst behaviors on a plane, and the bare feet was definitely one of them. I get that, you know, maybe the pressure and people wear shoes and the pressure in the air that changes things. But please, if you're thinking about taking off your shoes on the plane, make sure you have socks on that day because that is absolutely disgusting. We got to get to Donna from New York. Donna, you first of all, thanks for calling 720 WGN. And what's the worst thing you've ever seen when traveling?
Well, I originally called in to talk to you about my childhood in the 4th of July.
Oh, well, let's do that. Let's talk about that instead, Donna.
Okay, so I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay.
The patriotic singing group called the Teachers of America. So we would travel and we would sing songs from the 30s to the 70s and do a patriotic finale.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, it was super fun. But there was one particular 4th of July I will always remember. We were singing at a veterans hospital and a vet who hadn't spoken in many years when we started singing Grand Old Flag. Started singing with us.
Oh, that's so heartwarming.
It was really touching. And at the age of 12, I didn't realize what I realize now, how profound of a moment that was. But that's always been my very favorite 4th of July. And it was great. You know, growing up singing songs from the 30s to the 70s, doing a patriotic finale, I kind of grew up always respecting that. And then as an adult in New York, I work in television, and on 9/11, all I could really think about was just we were typing up words to say on camera, and all those lyrics that I sang as a child just came flooding through to me.
Wow.
I'm a very patriotic person, and when I was, and you guys are keeping me company, I'm driving back now to New York from Wausau, Wisconsin. Oh,
nice.
So I'm on Highway 80, and I was like, wow, I really like this radio show. These guys are great.
Oh, Donna, thank you so much. Well, we appreciate the phone call. And Donna, do you have kids now, if you don't want me asking?
I do. They are 27, 24, and 11.
Did you have them sing maybe while they were growing up to try and keep that tradition alive? Or did you let them make their own traditions or have your own traditions for the 4th?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. So the patriotic singing group still goes on in St. Louis, Missouri, and even though I live in New York. And my kids, they don't sing, but they are very creative and very patriotic. And so we make signs in our house. Like, our house is very over-decorated for every holiday. So that's one way that we participate. And then it's like barbecues and all the things. In Long Island, summer lasts all – it starts from Memorial Day, and it goes all the way through the 4th of July. So it's is the season, you know?
Absolutely. And since we got you on the line anyways, Donna, and we did prompt earlier, have you ever seen, you've done a lot of traveling in your life, you ever seen anything really disgusting on an airplane?
Yeah, I do travel a lot for work, and I guess for me, it's like, and I am a mom, please don't change your baby in the seat, you know, because take it back, you know?
Take the baby to the back and do it in the bathroom or something. Yeah, that's...
Although, can you fit with a baby in a bathroom?
I don't know. That's a good point. Does the baby fit in the bathroom? Maybe get the cart that the flight attendant uses and see if you could borrow that for a few minutes.
Where the food goes?
Well, after they're done with the food service. Donna, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it.
All right. Happy journey, you guys. Be well. Bye.
Thank you. Thanks, and good luck on your long journey from Wisconsin to New York.
I would say put a pad down.
On the cart or on the
on anything
tray
on any
table.
Surface where a baby's bottom is going
to
be.
A tray table in front of you, that does not seem like a great place to change a baby.
No, I'd be scared that people would go, they'd hit the reclining thing.
They'd recline,
there goes
right?
Baby.
There goes baby. Reclining on down. 312-981-7200. The worst things that you ever seen on an airplane, or let us know about your 4th of July traditions growing up or what you currently do now.
What have you seen that's bad?
You know, again, I've been lucky. I haven't seen anything that terrible. I've smelled a lot of things on airplanes. I can remember when we were coming back from Fort Lauderdale this January, we I smelled someone a couple rows back, and Brett and I were in the seats, and we were just like, oh, man, that smells so bad. And unfortunately, someone walked back, and they wanted to sit next to their friend, and he volunteered to move, and he ended up sitting right next to us. So we had identified that this gentleman smelled two rows away, and then all of a sudden he was sitting right next to us. I think there might have been an issue with him. And I, like, look, at the end of the day, it's not that long of a ride. It's a couple hours.
That's
great. And the smell...
There's that air nozzle.
The nozzle helps out. And I honestly just felt bad for the guy because I'm sure that he kind of had some hygiene issues. And there comes a point where it's like, man, I hate to make fun of this person or complain too much because here I am on an airplane coming back from a cruise. Life is good. And
right.
What's so bad? And I guess at the end of the day, that's all of these things. And that's the overall message is that at the end of the day, you're in an aluminum tube going 600 miles an hour at 40,000 feet. You should just be happy we're able to do that.
But that should also be, to turn it around, you're all in an aluminum tube stuck in here for so many hours.
That's true.
Come on.
Right. So I guess what I'm saying is the smelling thing is something that everyone has their own smells, and that's okay. And, you know, please try and wear deodorant if you have those means.
The one thing I remember as when smoking was still allowed, I remember they had a note, they had a smoking section, like that was going to help any. I remember being a little kid and just going like, huh.
You actually remember smoking on airplanes?
Yeah.
I do not at all.
I remember because I was flying and it was just so pungent.
Right.
Because you'd be like three rows back.
How the heck was that okay?
I don't
at
know.
At any point. Look,
and in restaurants, it was a thing. Like the no smoking section. It was just like, oh, here's a line, fake line where you can't smoke anymore. And it's like, it comes over.
I know. But in the moment, that felt fine. I remember that going to restaurants and I was like, okay, I'm smoking or not smoking.
You can smoke across the way, not right here.
Going to bars and before the Clean Air Ordinance Act in 2005, of course, those would be smoky. You don't think anything of that. But on airplanes, how was that ever okay? You are literally lighting a fire on a plane. I don't care if it's just in a sick, not even the smell of it, not even the health risk for the secondhand smoke. But just the fact that it's a fire on an airplane, like what?
Well, they learned better now.
I even think that the Wright brothers, when they were making this plane, was probably like, we probably shouldn't light our tobacco pipes on this thing because it's made of wood and it's going to burn. Like, I think even the first flight, they probably were like, yeah, shouldn't smoke on this thing. And yet we build these jets in the sky
with fuel and other things.
And spent cigarettes have brought down airplanes, not to worry anyone.
Oh, well, no, you can't smoke on a plane now. So.
I know, but back in the day, how were planes not just falling from the sky with the smoke from the engines and the tobacco smoke jetting out the windows, like, regularly? It's crazy.
You're a little paranoid there.
I am. Well, you know me in flying. I'm not a huge fan of it, but I cannot imagine smoking. Not smoking, but tobacco chewing. 708 texted that my boss sat in a window seat while a tobacco chewer sat in the aisle seat. After the drinks were served, the chewer put the empty glass on the floor in front of the empty middle seat and proceeded to spit into it for the rest of the flight. Like a spittoon?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you just do it like by your mouth like some of the chewers do, where they just kind of discreetly spit into it?
No, I think that's what they were doing. But it's a clear glass, so you
see everything.
The chewer
put the empty glass on the floor.
Right, so that could have gotten knocked over.
They used it like a spittoon, where they launched their spit. They didn't, like, bring it close to their mouth.
Really?
Yes.
Proceed to spit into it. No, I don't think that would be real messy.
Oh, maybe they lifted it up.
I think they did, but it's a clear glass, so it's kind of
that's disgusting.
Bleh.
By the end of the flight, the carpet in front of the empty seat was soaked in tobacco spit.
Oh,
I think they were
watching it. Was target practice. Come on.
That is, I mean, if you're going to chew on a plane, which is also disgusting.
Right.
Just to have a, just my brothers both chew, and it's the most disgusting thing. I don't know why they do it, but at least they have like a little, like a 2 liter, or not a 2 liter, but like a soda pop bottle, like a Sprite, and they spit it in there discreetly, which is still disgusting.
Someone goes, I want some Sprite.
They but they don't launch it onto the floor. I think that one takes the cake right there, 708.
Yeah, that is pretty funky. Good job, 708.
I've been around people that vomit on an airplane.
Well, yeah, I mean, they have barf bags
but,
for you.
Again,
so
that's I don't judge.
Expected.
I don't judge
that's
that
expected.
At all.
You can get kind of funky.
Right. Hey, do you have the... Oh, there we go. Thank you so mm-hmm. much, Esmeralda. Okay, so 312-981-7200. We want to hear all about your experiences on airplanes. A lot of people traveling. What's the worst thing that you've ever seen a fellow passenger do on an airplane? Or maybe you did it yourself and you're... ready
yeah,
to admit it here today.
Annoying.
Also, we would just want to hear about what you used to do on the 4th of July growing mm-hmm. up or things that you have planned. If you've got any traditions, we would love to hear about them. It is 2:31 right now. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago. It's 720 WGN, John Hanson, and man, you're busting out the moves, Esmeralda.
I love this song.
Everybody knows Esmeralda Leon, of course, during this shift. You're rocking it today. We're in for Nick DiGilio. He'll be back tomorrow, though, right?
Yes.
He's just taking the one
yes,
day off.
Just 4th of July.
Good for him. God, I love listening to you guys. I know I say this every time we fill in for Nick, but you guys get my morning started every single day from 4 to 5.
We look forward to the messages you send me. Because I'm always like, John just sent me a message.
I know. I chime
dumb.
In. I chime in way too much. Well, when you don't know musical stuff. So we're talking about 4th of July. Any traditions that you had growing up
yes.
or that you've continued on with your kids? And we're also talking about, in that vein, traveling, the worst things you've ever seen on an airplane. 312-981-7200. And Vic Vaughn, I don't mean to call you out. I just want to kind of ask you here. I was about to ask you if you fly a lot, but I know that, of course, you were in the Air Force for many. Did anyone on any Air Force planes ever do anything disgusting? I imagine that's all pretty, you keep that decorum pretty well.
You know, yeah, I can't think of anything on
an
Air Force plane.
No one's smoking on
Everyone tends to behave during missions.
No one's smoking on an F-18 or something like that.
No, but I will say, I do have a quick story. Yeah. Flying from a certain location to another location, I had to stop in Haiti. And it was a commercial flight, and there were millions of mosquitoes that came on the plane.
Oh,
we stopped on the tarmac, and they opened the door and just infiltrated us.
Oh, my gosh.
The flight attendants literally came down the aisles with spray cans.
Oh,
assume it happens often when they stop. There are spray cans of, like... You know, stuff to kill the mosquitoes, but
That's the one flight I wish everyone would then light a cigarette on to kill the mosquitoes.
Did they put a net or something on the filter?
And by the way, that was the original screenplay for Snakes on a Plane. It was just mosquitoes, but it just didn't quite have as much buzz. Okay, see, that was too easy.
Woo, okay.
Yeah, mosquitoes on the plane. That is
disgusting.
Was everyone like slapping their arms?
Yes.
It
was as soon as they opened the doors, they were just. And we were all just getting bit and just
I also now want to. I now want to guess where you were flying to and from, but I won't go down that road.
Oh, you might be able to guess it.
Fort Lauderdale to. I don't know.
You got the.
Florida.
I was going to Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
So you got the destination right.
Puerto Rico? No.
No.
Oh, I know where you were because you told me.
Yeah.
Is this
a
classified?
It was
Caribbean.
It was Curacao.
Oh, I didn't know.
Didn't want to make the long story long.
Okay. I didn't know if this was like classified information or something.
No. It's a commercial flight.
Oh, okay.
The thing was,
this was a commercial.
I didn't even know I was stopping in Haiti. I bought a flight on American Airlines from Curacao to Florida because I was coming onto Chicago.
Right.
But you have to stop in Florida. And they said, we're stopping in Haiti. It was a direct flight. So that means you're making a stop. But I didn't even notice that.
Did they ever...
So I'm like, we're stopping in Haiti?
What? Yeah. Well, they had to pick up the mosquitoes. They had to bring those on in. So,
crazy.
Oh, thanks, Vic. 312-981-7200. We had a text from 708 saying happy 4th to us and everyone out there. Don't have as much time to travel as much as this listener would like to, but he or she was raised with proper manners. Basically, treat others as you'd like to be treated. I think that's a really good... thing.
That
it's a good lesson. Instead of the flight attendants telling you how to put on the seatbelt, they should probably do that too.
Right.
But they should just tell you that. They should be like, by the way, we're on an airplane. You're with 150 of your closest friends now. Just be a human being for a second.
Yeah. By the way, if you didn't know, this is a plane.
Right.
Don't be dumb.
Right. We're stopping in Haiti. First and foremost, we're stopping in Haiti. We're picking up the mosquitoes. Here's your bug spray. Point two, don't spittoon on the floor.
I would have gotten so paranoid.
If you stopped in Haiti or because of the bugs?
No, with the bugs.
Oh, yeah. No, that sounds disastrous.
No, I'm just because that happens even just like today outside. You think like any itch, you're like, oh, a bug. once.
Honestly, the worst part about that flight that Vic mentioned was the unexpected landing, because I hate the takeoff part. So if I had to do that twice, that's why I don't do connecting flights. If I can absolutely avoid it, I don't mind landing. Once we are in the air and going, I am fine. I feel good. But and I don't mind the landing at all, because that's when me and the pilot are on the same page. We're going to get this plane down to the ground safely.
I don't, you know what?
But I hate the takeoff. So
I hate
two
it,
of those.
But I'm not that big of a a problem. I do my little, you know, up, down, side to side.
Oh, you do the little cross thing? Yeah.
Because that's going to save me.
Yeah, that'll be the difference. Then when that
it
plane's
is.
Going
I
down.
Do it every time, because I'm like,
No, you might as well not tempt fate. See, I'm not going to start doing that, because I've never done it and I've been fine till now, so I don't want to tempt fate. 773 says that she or he heard that on Russian airline Aeroflots,
Aeroflot?
Or I don't think about Aeroflight. They, flight attendants were in the galley cooking over an open flame.
Hey, I want fresh food.
No, at what cost? What are they making? What are they cooking? Like a steak? Like a little filet?
I want a steak.
Some fondue in the back? I don't know.
Yeah. Ooh, that sounds nice.
Or just a Russian fondue.
Mm.
No open flames on any planes, please. Kathy chimed in from the 920, which I don't know where that area code is. But speaking of odors, on the way to Vegas, someone had nasty flatulence, which is a nice way to put that. More than once, the worst part was it came through the plane's air system.
Yeah, well, that's the big part of it is that
it's all recycled.
Yeah, that's not. It's the same air, and it's just going to keep going. Although you'd think they would have something to kind of get rid of certain.
Well, not at 40,000 feet. Maybe if they descended down to 10,000, where it's breathable air again, just open the door really quickly.
No,
just a quick little. People
just
with the emergency exits, I know there's problems sometimes where people want to get off the plane. And that's another fear of mine. That's why I always try and
open the plane.
Well, that's what they freak out in the air and they try to open the door. Yeah, you even heard of this?
Yeah, but then you just tackle.
This is why I try and sit in the exit row, because I would prevent someone from doing that.
Really? No.
Oh, I have my eyes on those doors all the time.
Oh, I don't.
I'm not a fun person to fly with, if you haven't figured this out.
Okay, good. Noted. We're not going on vacation together anytime soon. Road trip.
We got a call from Paxton. Paxton, what's the one thing that maybe you've seen someone do on a plane, or advice for someone that they shouldn't do on the plane?
Good morning, John. Yes. I love
good morning.
I'll continue with the Fort Lauderdale theme. Coming into Fort Lauderdale through the passage, they thought they'd have a contest, and you would fill out the reason that a plane flies.
They handed out, like, pieces of paper to everyone on the plane?
Right, and you would write down how does a plane fly.
Okay.
Would you get a prize if you got it right?
What's that?
Did you get a prize if you got it right?
Oh, yeah. Everybody filled it out, and the good ones were read over the intercom, and then everybody thought, hey, why don't we ask the pilot? Really tell us. And so the pilot came on, and he said, well, planes fly because everybody thinks they'll fly.
Oh.
Therefore, they do.
What is it? What, the plane's Tinkerbell now? If we all clap at the same time, it'll... What is going on?
I think I saw him on the way out. He looked like a new age person to it, but it didn't really drive you with confidence when he said it.
No.
I would imagine not.
In fact, the only reason I feel okay about flying is because I understand the physics of it. That at the end of the day, as long as there's motion pushing us forward and the wing is properly shaped, that we're going to be totally fine to fly. But Paxton, do you mind telling us what airline that was? Was it Southwest?
Yeah. What was the guy's name?
I think it was the James Bond. This was a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
It was the James Bond airline. Pan Am.
Oh, okay. And that's why they're no longer around. They started asking people for advice on how the planes fly.
We all think hard enough.
Long ago, they used to have a contest about how long it would take you, not how long it would take you to get there. They would give you a mathematical thing where you would figure it out. This is back before there was any music on the plane. While you were smoking, you could figure out little brain teasers.
We're going to give you two cigarettes to figure out exactly what's going on here. Paxton, I'm fascinated that I've been on flights where the flight attendants are fun and they might make a joke or two, but never this sort of interactive jeopardy in the air. This sounds like a blast. See, I would like flying if this was the case.
Well, see, there were about 40 people on the plane, and out of those 40, maybe maybe half a dozen had something worthwhile to say about it.
Paxton, I got to ask. So we were talking about smoking on planes. Esmeralda remembers it. We're about the same age in the 30s, I should say. And I don't actually remember smoking on planes. When you were flying in a plane and people were smoking, did you even think twice about it? Did anyone raise objections? Or was it just so normal no one cared?
Yeah, I was listening to what you were saying about that earlier. To be honest, I thought it was just normal. In fact, though, I would always ask for the window seat, thinking that maybe by the window it would be fresher air.
They don't open, Paxton, or maybe they did back then. And that's another thing I don't know about planes.
Feel the breeze.
Feel the nice breeze coming up through.
Arm out, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Do the little wave thing out the window. Paxton, we appreciate the phone call.
Okay, I must be off.
Yeah, have a great day. Thanks. No, 312-981-7200. Worst things you've ever seen on the plane. I want to hear from someone that has smoked on a plane. Please call us, 312-981-7200, smokers or former smokers. I want to know, like, the thought process of lighting a lighter or a match on a plane and whether that was ever weird to you. You can text us as well, but I'd love to hear from a smoker who's actually smoked in an airplane. I don't know what I want to break down about this.
Well, it's also a thing of, like, you know, back in the 50s. Doctors are like, no, smoking's cool.
No, I totally. And everyone's
like, okay.
Look, I'm not going to judge a single person for calling in who smokes or has smoked or anything along those lines. I just really want to hear from this. But we got to take a quick break. It's John and Esmeralda in for Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio is out tonight. John Hanson, and you all know her, you all love her. It's Esmeralda Leon.
Hi.
You're doing double duty. You're also doing traffic today.
Yeah.
So you got to prep for that. And she has a new sign-in for traffic for anyone that missed the beginning of the show. It is everybody shut up now before she reads the traffic report.
Everybody be quiet,
everybody
please.
Be quiet. Ask and ye shall receive. I'm so excited to get this phone call. Charlie says that, Charlie, well, you've smoked on an airplane, right?
Oh, yes, I did, sir.
You seem very proud of that.
I was in the Army in 1974, and we took a flight overseas, but we left Southern, but we couldn't get off the runway. It wasn't long enough to have the jet itself fully fueled.
Okay.
So we had to go to LaGuardia and fill up. We had over 350 guys on the plane, and I'd say, 75 or 85% of the people smoked.
But on a jet, so this isn't just on a transport vehicle.
It was a transport,
okay.
Yes, but it was a jet that flew across the ocean.
And no one batted an eye at this.
No, because back then it was like, you know, cigarettes were kind of still cool. You know, the Marlboro Man hadn't died yet, stuff like that.
Which, by the way, that is not why the FAA took off smoking.
Right.
They're like, well, the Marlboro Man's right. dead. The
not
FAA
cool
took it
anymore.
Off because it's incredibly dangerous. Well,
the thing is that people didn't realize that you smoke, everybody smokes, because all the air is in this cabin, it just goes back and forth.
Yes.
Right, yeah.
You know, it was Esmeralda, I love you because I listen to WGN all the time. And they used to do something. They used to play Esmeralda Leon, but they played it to a song. What was that song?
Oh, it was an Elton John song. I couldn't
remember. Yeah, we need to bring that back.
Remember.
Yeah,
we should bring that back. No,
yeah,
some of the girls don't like that stuff. Like, you know, Kim Gordon doesn't like to be called the commissioner's daughter either. So.
Right.
I feel like news is a little different.
Yeah. Hey, Charlie, thank you for the phone call. I'm glad that we got a smoker on a plane. I don't know why I'm fascinated by this subject, but I've got Brian as well. Brian, did you serve in Vietnam? And you say you smoked on airplanes too. Brian, are you there? I think I lost. Brian, can you hear me? I don't know if Brian can hear me anymore.
I don't think he's on.
Oh, let me. Hey, Brian, can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can.
Yeah, I'm filling in for Nick. Sometimes the buttons, they don't quite work the way I think they should. So you smoked on airplanes.
That's okay. Welcome. Happy 4th of July.
Yeah, you too as well.
For the guy and the gal there. I can't call you guys and I can't call you girls. So.
That's true. Guys and dolls, you could say.
Okay.
Or the guy in the doll. We'll say that.
Well, that too.
Yeah.
I bet she is. I've never seen her. So, but I used to. I didn't start smoking until I was in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
You know, when I first hit there, I was like 18 years old, and this is back in like 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so, but anyways, after being there for a certain amount of time, they would fly me, you know, to Hawaii and, you know, get on this aircraft out of Saigon, and which is now Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, the everybody smoked on the aircraft. And they used to have ashtrays in the individual seats.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah. And the stewardesses, they used to hang out in the back and smoke.
Brian, it just never struck you, this is just how people did it, and it never bothered you?
No, never bothered me one bit. I mean, I never thought about it, you know, until you brought the subject up.
Yeah, it's just something that nowadays it would seem so foreign to me on an airplane if this would happen. But back in the day, it wasn't. Hey, Brett, so you served in Vietnam?
Yes, I did.
Well, we appreciate your sacrifices and your services to our country, and you're one of the many reasons why we're able to celebrate this 4th of July. And thank you so much for the phone call this morning.
Thank you. Have a great
Porsche. Yeah, you too, as well.
Thanks.
The guy in the doll here, by the way. I think that's what we should go by now.
We should have a thing like the guy in the doll.
It's the guy in the doll. All right, so Mike, you didn't smoke on airplanes, but your dad did, right?
Yeah, how you doing tonight?
Yeah, good morning.
Good.
I don't know when that ban went into effect, but I want to say it was like in the mid-80s, because when I was in college, I had a professor who was a big-time activist, and he used to write letters to the airlines, to Congress, and everything. It was, like, his number one issue. And so, anyway, my dad one day had to go to Toronto for business, and he's on the plane, and they already put this smoking ban into effect. So he gets on the plane, and the plane takes off. It goes up, and he takes out his cigarettes and lights one up. And all of a sudden, the stewardess comes over and says, sir, you know, you're not allowed to smoke anymore on planes. And so my dad says, really? And the stewardess says, yeah, you're not allowed to smoke on planes anymore. It's, you know, it's a federal law or whatever. And so my dad says, well, let me ask you a question. When is Toronto a domestic flight? See, when the ban first came out, it was only for domestic flights for, like, the first year.
Okay,
so then all of a sudden she went back to the pilot. The pilot called down to the tower.
Oh my gosh.
And then the tower came back a couple minutes later and said it was okay for my dad to smoke on the plane. My dad was telling me the whole plane broke out in applause. And then after that, about 10 or 12 more people broke out cigarettes, and there was about 15 people smoking.
Oh my God, that is the longest length I think anyone's ever gone in human history to smoke a cigarette, that it had to be communications between an airplane in the air and the tower on the ground. And I love that it goes out in applause. But, Mike, doesn't it seem so strange to you that, I mean, nowadays, if someone lit a cigarette on the plane, mm-hmm. you'd have 200 people looking at them immediately. I mean,
you'd get in trouble. I think it's law.
Oh, you would be in a lot of trouble.
You'd be real in trouble.
Right. They would be coming down the aisle to choke you.
Yeah.
Well, they do that. You don't have to smoke on planes even for that anymore, Mike. They'll do that for free these days. Hey, Mike, we appreciate the phone call. Thanks so much for listening this morning.
Have a good 4th of July.
Yeah, you too. Happy Independence Day. Smoking in flight prohibited by almost all airlines. On domestic airliners, for example, it was banned on flights with a duration of 2 hours or less in 1988. So at first, if you were on a long flight, they'd be like, well, we get it. Got to smoke. Because, you know, the nicotine, it's addictive.
Right,
so if it's under 2 hours.
Craving.
And then by the end of the 90s, it was completely, all planes were smoke-free by then. Ralph Nader was one of the big advocates, among the first to call for a smoking ban on airlines. You might remember Ralph Nader from the 2000 election, mm-hmm. long before that, as someone who advocated for seatbelts in cars. So he's a big safety and transportation guy. United Airlines was the first to implement a non-smoking section, but both tobacco companies and airlines, they fought the regulations. The airlines did themselves. I imagine anything that keeps customers not as happy as they once were is something that they are not all about.
Exactly. And I remember it was just a section, a non-smoking section, but there was nothing up that would make it.
No.
It was just like three rows here are all smoking, and then we all have to just sit with the smoke.
And again, the oxygen that gets recycled through the plane would be recycled through the whole section. It's not like they walled it off.
Well, and it would just kind of float back to where you were It was, yeah, I'm like a little kid, like...
Right. People wonder now why there's still some no smoking signs on planes, and obviously some planes are still in service from that time. Actually, I'm trying to think of...
Well, and also I'm thinking people are just...
Yeah, they want to let you know.
...awful, and they all light up.
Right, and they still want to... And people ask why there's an ashtray in the bathroom, because people... because planes still have to have ashtrays in the bathroom. And the reason for that, and they let you know that you're not allowed to do it, but if you are... I mean, I imagine... I imagine what they want you to do, right, if you open it up, they know you're in trouble.
Fired alarm.
I just imagine that they have them in there because it's like, look, if you really want to risk going to jail, paying this fine, please at least put the cigarette out in an ashtray, but not in the garbage because that's brought down planes. When people throw a cigarette into the garbage with all the napkins and everything in there, that's what causes the problems.
Makes sense.
So they're like, well, we'll just keep the ashtray there just in case.
Goodness gracious.
Someone wants to do with that. We had a text come in from another veteran from spending some time overseas. Thank you for your service from the 773. We appreciate that.
I like the 708. They sat next to someone who started flossing their teeth.
Oh, my gosh.
How do you even do that without looking?
I can floss. I can floss without a mirror. Yeah.
I need a mirror.
I use one of the little things now. That has the little piece of floss that has it built in.
The little...
And what do you call those?
I don't know.
The little doohickey.
It's got the little stick.
It's got the little stick floss.
It's like a little...
Floss sticker.
Like it looks like a... Not a razor, but a... A potato peeler. It does! It's like
it
a little
really
U,
does.
And then it's got the... It's like
a little potato peeler flosser thingy.
For your teeth.
I'm surprised they don't advertise it like that.
I use one of those, so
I don't need to look at those. But I imagine that what's wrong about the flossing is, well, everything.
It
goes everywhere.
Oof. Have you ever looked at your mirror?
Gums are bleeding everywhere.
Oh, no.
You just go in there like, oh, stewardess, can I have some water, please? I need to rinse out my bloody mouth.
And then you just spit it in the eye.
And then you do it into the spittoon.
Oh, there you go.
Here were the five worst things to do on planes. And we're coming up on the news here in a moment. But unwanted physical contact.
Mm-hmm.
So a person wrote into this article, the worst behavior I've ever seen on a plane. I had reclined my seat and fallen asleep. Woke up to the man grabbing my arm and yelling at me in another language. That's not good.
I know there's a lot of people that the people just fall to the side on them.
Yeah.
I'd be like, no, wake up.
I know we don't have time to talk about this now. We got this great historian coming in, and I'm sure the Declaration of Independence is more important than the one I want to see.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of curious. Maybe people can text in.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on the reclining of the seat? This really divides people. Because some people say, like, don't recline. Come on, man. Let's all just stay upright. It's not that long of a flight. It doesn't really do much. But it really, if you do recline into someone and they don't recline back, man, it really messes up. It really gets in your way.
Yeah, well, for me, because my legs are pretty short, I have plenty of space. So if someone does recline, it doesn't bother me. But I can understand if you're a big, long-legged person.
But then, yeah, and then people say,
it smacks your knees.
I paid for this flight. We are allowed to do this. We should be able to do this. Hey, we got to take the quickest break in the history of time, and then we'll be back in the news. You're listening to 720 WGN.
720 WGN.
I didn't even turn my microphone off. That's how... short that break was. You did, Esmeralda.
I did.
You were a little worried there.
I'm worried about breathing into the microphone.
Man, I worry about a lot of things, but breathing is not one of them. All right, we're going to be talking about the creation of the Declaration of Independence. I imagine a few people out there might know all of the 55 keywords that started off. It's much longer than that, but the first 55. But I know that a lot of people probably know we hold these truths to be self-evident, and we want to hear about how that all came to be here on this Independence Day. It's going to be a fascinating conversation, I promise you. Really cool stuff that's going to come up after the news.
We the people of the United States.
In order to form a more perfect union, establish justice.
Ensure domestic tranquility. Provide for the common defense.
Promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity.
Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States.
720 WGN, a nice little reading of the Constitution, which of course was ratified a few years after our Declaration of Independence in 1776. And joining us now is David Shostakis. Did I get it right, David?
Perfect.
There you go.
Thanks so much, John.
David, you're a historian, and you do a lot of other great things. And you've written a couple books now. And this is the most recent one, right? Creating the Declaration of Independence.
June 14th was when it was published. So just...
Hot off the
3 weeks.
Right. Oh. I was reading, we had you on UME on WCIU last week to talk about some interesting facts about the signing of the Declaration of Independence. I was reading the book last night, and there are Cheeto crumbs everywhere because that was my treat to myself yesterday.
Okay.
And I realized that it is the worst. Never read a book while you're having Cheetos. It is
It would be good to highlight. You want to highlight little passages.
You could just take your finger, run across the Cheetos.
And... Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I took this really nice signed copy that you left for me, David, and now there's Cheeto highlight everywhere. And apparently, according to my highlighting, I found a lot of things important every single page.
What did you
off to the right side of every page, I thought it was important. David, where does your fascination begin with this time period? Have you always been interested in the independence era of American history?
I've always been interested in the heritage of America and the things that make us special and make us America. And I can trace that back really to my grandmother, who was one of 11 children in Lithuania.
Wow.
8 of whom were killed by Russian occupiers.
Oh, my goodness.
3 of whom were fortunate enough to make it to the United States. She came over on one of those boats when she was 15 years old. But ultimately, while she was born in September, she required us to celebrate her birthday on the 4th of July.
Really?
Because that was the anniversary of her becoming an American citizen. And the way Grandma would say it was that's when she considered herself to have been truly born. Oh, and so I am blessed to have that kind of personal family heritage from the youngest age.
Man, that perspective really helps because I think a lot of us take a lot of this for granted. We really do. The freedoms that we have currently, you know, a lot more people are free in this world than they used to be, but it certainly isn't everyone. And man, things have changed a lot since this document really came about. I think that's something you mentioned in the introduction as you get started, is that until this moment when it was announced in the Second Continental Congress that there was going to be this Declaration of Independence and it was written about a month later in July, no one had really written something like that down before.
Truly, nobody had actually written anything like that down. There was historical development of the thoughts, but Jefferson was the one that actually distilled them in a way that obviously has stood the test of time. Prior to that, for 10,000 years, any time a government overthrew a king, which is what these guys were about to do, all the people really did was get themselves a new king.
Right.
All the,
I think there's a song about that. Meet the old boss, same as the new boss. I believe that was written about the transfer of kings.
In that time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And so this was unique in the history of the world. And I think people don't understand that for 10,000 years, all of human history before then, that's exactly how, you know, it was sort of like a game of Stratego. They trade a king for one king, and they trade territory, and they trade peoples. And so the idea that you were going to start a new country based on a philosophy rather than based on fear.
Right.
This was an incredible, incredible leap forward. And to think that it's only 240 years compared to 10,000 previous.
Right.
Yeah. How long did it take from them talking to, like, let's put things on paper?
10,000 years.
In many ways, the ideas had fermented, but...
Right. But when were they like, okay... We have these things.
Okay.
Let's write them down.
Well, actually, Richard Henry Lee, who, by the way, there's three Richard Henry Lee who actually proposed independence on June 7, 1776. He was the very first guy to say this in public, absent two outliers, one being Thomas Paine.
Right. Common sense.
The other being Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death.
Mm-hmm.
Absent those two guys, nobody mentioned the word independence in public. For a number of reasons, not the least of which is it could cost you your head, literally. And so Richard Henry Lee proposed this on June 7, 1776, and by the 4th of July, the Declaration of Independence was approved and issued. So Jefferson actually got assigned to write this about the 13th of June, and they presented their work on June the 26th. Only a couple of weeks. The book explains part of how Jefferson did that so quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I find it fascinating walking through the history. And I think this is something that we don't grasp a lot having... We hear about the Revolutionary War during classes, and until you really dive in either to your book or to David McCullough's books, he's written some great
work. I love David McCullough.
Is that gunfire, Lexington and Concord, comes before the Declaration of Independence. I think a lot of people think that, okay, we declare war or we declare independence, then there's war and it happens. But there have been so many festering things, little outbreaks of violence that had happened between the colonies and the British Crown. But really, our founding fathers had played this interesting legal game. They were all lawyers, or a lot of them were lawyers. This legal game of still pledging allegiance to the crown while supporting the efforts of revolutionaries. It was must have been a delicate balance for them at first.
It was an incredibly delicate balance for them in a number of ways. As you mentioned, Lexington and Concord had been in April of 1775. And then Bunker Hill in June of 1775, and at those two, excuse me, those three altercations, about 165 Americans were killed.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, there already had been significant bloodshed. In the early portions of 1776, George Washington was consolidating the army for the defense of New York, and British troops were sailing down from Halifax in Canada to seize New York. So they were already at war,
pretty much,
as a practical matter. Mm-hmm. However, they pretended from a political standpoint that they weren't at war with the king, that they were at war with the Parliament, these terrible people that had imposed a few pennies tax on some legal documents.
Right. Was that to keep their own head? Literally.
Yeah, literally it was, because the penalties for treason were for treason against the king.
Okay.
So when they could claim that they continued to have allegiance to the king, that was sort of a legal protection against being charged with treason.
So you're saying lawyers have always been lawyers?
Lawyers have always been lawyers.
Looking for the exact lane that they can go in to still make it right. And by the way, we've had a text saying they're truly enjoying this conversation. But if you have any questions, obviously, 312-981-7200, give us a text or a call. We'd love to have a little interaction. So really,
let's back up to Richard Henry Lee for just one second.
It's not a name that a lot of people know right off the bat, I will say.
No, they don't know him off the bat. But an interesting little factoid about Richard Henry Lee is that at 64th and Tripp, here in Chicago, mm-hmm. there is Richard Henry Lee Elementary School.
Really?
And there's a school here in Chicago, Lee Elementary, that's named after Richard Henry
Lee. I
didn't
know that.
So here in Chicago, so in some respects, on WGN, Richard Henry Lee is kind of one of Chicago's very own.
Oh, there you go.
And that's a great lead into the commercial break there. So you got the tagline. When we come back, though, what I love about the book and I love about all these stories is that these are men. We look at them as statues, and you mentioned that in your introduction. We think of them as marble statues out there, but these are living, breathing men, obviously mostly men. And, of course, we can talk about that for ages, about how, of course, women became more involved in politics, but not for two more centuries. But the idea that they have families, that they have faults, that they have desires, they have different things, and the living, breathing thing. And I would love for you to kind of set us up and walk through those few weeks between June 7th and July 4th. All right, so more with, David Shostakis. There you go, two for two here on 720 WGN right after this. WGN and a happy Independence Day to everybody out there. Thank you so much for listening. It's John Hanson and Esmeralda Leon. You all know Esmeralda. And she's doing double duty tonight, traffic mm-hmm. and how do you manage,
watching
Esmeralda?
Watching those crazy roads.
Oh, what is happening out there this morning?
Not much.
On June 7th, 1776, Virginia's Richard Henry Lee stood up in the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia and offered a resolution that would forever change the course of history. Resolved that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. David Shostakis didn't write those words particularly, but wrote the lead into that in his book, Creating the Declaration of Independence. And him saying that out loud, him being Virginia's Richard Henry Lee, as we mentioned, I mean, it was a really big deal, and that set a lot of things into motion. But as you tell the story, David, it is fascinating to hear about what else happened in Congress that day. I love the mundane details. Because we think of these moments as like these big, epic, dramatic music rolling underneath, but really that this is all part of the general ebb and flow of the Continental Congress.
Was part of the general. Well, this
stood out, of course.
This stood out a little bit differently, but there was general ebb and flow. There was general business. They had to pay the army. They had to figure out ways to acquire acquire gunpowder. There was the Continental Congress had commandeered someone else's private ship, a sloop called Endeavor, and they were trying to figure out how they were going to compensate the owner of the Endeavor. These things are actually available for folks in the Library of Congress. You can look and read the records of the Second Continental Congress, what they did day in and day out. And so these things are available. And so they had day in and day out legislative kind of mundane business. And during the course of that day, Richard Henry Lee knew what he was about to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kind of frustrated by the fact that they were going through these things.
Right. He's got this big news.
And he's got this big news. And nobody's ever uttered the word independence in the Congress before. And he's listening to them talking about gunpowder and ships and South Carolina militia and things like that. And he's going, my goodness, why have we not mentioned independence when, for all practical purposes, we're in the middle of conducting a war?
And it's interesting because some of the delegates are sent there, I imagine, as representatives of their individual colonies, and that their legislatures in each individual colony had certain rules that they had, guidelines that they had sent their delegates with. So when we talk about independence fervor, it wasn't as if when he said this, there was a chorus of, yes, we all agree there were some, but not everyone's on board right away.
The only person that seconded his motion seconded his resolution when he presented it was, in fact, John Adams. There was only one other person that stepped out on what I describe as the limb of treason.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, treason was a big deal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Was a big deal. And the penalties for treason were terrible. Certainly, as it begins, they cut your guts out.
Right.
You know,
literally,
you get disemboweled is how the law reads from that day. And after you disemboweled, then you get hung, but you're cut down before you die. And so apparently there was somebody very, very skilled to be able to take your guts out and hang you and still
keep you alive. Wow.
And still keep you alive.
Right.
And then at that point you were burned. And then after you were burned, your head was cut off and you were drawn and quartered. And then after your head was cut off, it was put on a spit for display to say that it wasn't a good idea to cross the king.
Man, the British and their flair, they don't let up even in killing people.
Did that happen a lot?
Well, here's an interesting thing. At one point, I was a Cook County prosecutor. I've been involved in the criminal justice system, and certainly there's a lot of penalties in the law that are so horrendous relative mm-hmm. to some of the crimes, almost nobody ever suffers them.
Yeah.
However, these fellas knew personally some folks that had, in fact, their heads cut off. Prime among them, or more perhaps most famous among them, was a fellow by the name of Dr. Joseph Warren. Dr. Joseph Warren was the Adams family personal physician mm-hmm. who took a bullet to his head during Bunker Hill. And following the Battle of Bunker Hill, there was a British execution squads that toured the battleground to make sure patriots that were laying on the ground were in fact dead.
Oh, wow.
And they had taken some bayonets and mutilated Dr. Warren's body and then ultimately cut off his head, put it on mm-hmm. a spit for display. And so interesting thing about that, they were able to later determine that, in fact, this head was Dr. Joseph Warren's because Paul Revere was a silversmith, but he was also some of his silver work was utilized in dentistry.
Wow.
And the first case of forensic dentistry in North America was determining, in fact, that this was Dr. Joseph Warren's head because they were able to identify the Paul Revere's work in his mouth.
Oh, wow.
That's graphic, but again, it underlies the real concern that these men had when they say these things.
Yeah, there was a real concern, and so there was no... They actually knew people who had their heads cut off in terms of the treason situation. And so when Richard Henry Lee is going to Congress that day, and while he's hearing the mundane things that you're talking about, he's considering the fact that he is endangering himself of having his head cut off.
So he makes this resolution in the Congress. John Adams quickly seconds it. And then what happens next? Is it a matter of people argue back and forth? They debate it out that day? Or is everything kind of tabled for later? Is it, does it go through the motions that we're very familiar with now of the how things work in Congress and legislative bodies, where sometimes things don't go as quickly as we'd like?
They immediately determined that they weren't going to vote right at that particular point in time. They, as you say, tabled it and set a vote for the 2nd of July for a couple of reasons. Prime among them is, of course, we have our people that go to Congress, and they have their own heads and theoretically represent us. The members of the Continental Congress operated under strict directions of their home government.
Okay.
They could only vote how their home government would allow them or gave them instructions to vote. In fact, Lee had instructions from the colony of Virginia to propose independence. He didn't, he had instructions for Virginia to do this. And so several of the colonies had not given their representatives the authority to vote on independence. So they needed a couple of weeks.
I'm glad that our history of politicians goes right back to the beginning of our politicians being mouthpieces, goes way back in time to the very beginning, whether they're representing industries or their state governments. So then does everyone, because I know obviously transportation, this isn't an easy thing. They're in Philadelphia. Maybe in a couple of weeks you can get back and forth to New Jersey, but do the representatives from Virginia, South Carolina, do they go back to talk, or do they stay in Philadelphia and communicate via, I don't know, how do they get this permission then to eventually vote on this thing?
A number of them went back to their home governments. Prime stumbling block really turned out to be New York and Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And the New York guys went back. Pennsylvania wasn't so bad because they're meeting in Philadelphia.
They're right there, yeah.
They're meeting in Philadelphia. And the Pennsylvania delegation was actually split themselves in terms of
Benjamin Franklin being someone probably for independence, of course.
Ben Franklin was strongly in favor of independence. On the other hand, the other member of the Pennsylvania delegation was a fellow by the name of John Dickinson, and Dickinson was not in favor of independence. Ultimately, a couple of weeks later, when they did vote on independence, Dickinson had stormed out of the room, and Franklin voted for him while he was gone. And that's how the Pennsylvania vote for independence came about, because Dickinson had absented himself from the room at the time.
Oh, that Ben Franklin.
Oh, Franklin was a character. And Richard Henry Lee made this proposal, and then they had a couple of weeks to go. Franklin, on June 12th, nominated Thomas Jefferson to join the committee to draft the declaration.
Because they actually form committees. I mean, they go through the legislative motions of this thing.
Absolutely.
I think we all picture like this rah-rah, let's do it, or fine, we'll vote in a couple of weeks, let's go talk about it. But there is actually the legislative nuts and bolts that this has to go through.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. They formed actually three committees as a result of Lee's resolution. One was to draft a declaration. Mm-hmm. One was to, in fact, put together a plan for a potential new government should, in fact, they declare independence. And then the third one was to put together a plan to seek allies, i.e. France, Spain, seek external allies. And so they put together three committees as a result of Lee's resolution. And then within a week, Jefferson got appointed to the committee to draft the declaration. Lee actually probably would have been the appropriate Virginian on the committee, but he was, you mentioned at the beginning, that people had real lives and other kinds of situations, and Lee's wife had gotten extraordinarily ill, and he'd gotten a message that called him back to Virginia because of the illness of his wife. And that's one of the reasons that Jefferson wound up on the committee.
Really? Isn't that fascinating, the turns that history takes? What's the old thing? The butterfly flaps his wings and
right.
Blah, blah, blah. But clearly I don't remember the end of it, but something else happens. But the idea that these little twists and turns. Okay, so now we're at the point where this committee has been formed to write the Declaration of Independence, and we're going to get to that here in the second half hour, because that is a whole nother fascinating story. Again, we're with David Shostokas, who wrote Creating the Declaration of Independence. If someone's interested in this, but maybe they got a run already and they can't listen to the second half hour, I just want to let people know, where can people find the book?
On Amazon. It's both in a Kindle edition or in print.
They can can read it because she loves her Kindle.
Wonderful.
All right, we'll have more with David in just a little bit. Quick break, then news here on 720 WGN.
Weekdays, WGN Radio comes to TV. Don't just listen, but watch The Steve Cochran Show each morning from 9 to 10 for a little news, talk, and fun. And then afternoons from 3 to 4, watch The Rocon Show with Anna DeVantis and get Rose's unique take on the day's news. Catch an hour of The Steve Cochran Show and The Rocon Show with Anna DeVantis weekdays only on CLTV.
Happy Independence, everybody. Independence Day. We're going to continue our conversation with a historian about how this all happens, this Declaration of Independence, how we get the words that we end up with. I am Esmeralda, can you tell I'm geeking out over this stuff?
It's good, though.
It's really good to know
the history of things.
Right. Just the really the mundane details mixed with this fascinating stuff, and we'll get to the rest of that in just a little bit. We'd love for you to join the conversation, 312-981-7200. We're with David Shostakis, and now I'm 3 for 4 with your name, David. That's pretty good. Who wrote Creating the Declaration of Independence, and we're diving through the history of that fateful summer in Philadelphia, 1776, diving into exactly how it comes to be. And what I love about your book, David, and it's available on Amazon, is, and look, I love reading David McCullough books and diving so far deep into them, having long chapters of sprawling prose, you cite every source and all that sort of stuff. To me, that seems fascinating, but you really approach this book, not to say that it's downplayed anyway, but it's manageable. It's chewable, I guess you could say. And you walk us through things in a very plain spoken way. And that's not saying that it's an insult, it's a really consumable way to understand this history.
Well, thank you very much. We work hard to, of course, I'm an attorney as well, and so you wind up having to work very, very hard to translate attorney work into regular non-attorney work.
Right.
And so I'm very, very lucky in that certainly I've got family editors that will say, Dave, I don't get this, you know. And so we work very, very hard to, in this book, the first book, Constitutional Soundbites, the writing on my website, shostakis.com, we work very, very hard to make sure that the explanations are not legalese. And I work to actually kind of strip the legalese away from some of these things because, frankly, as Thomas Jefferson said, what he was trying to do with the Declaration of Independence was just explain the common sense of the matter.
How important, and that transitions perfectly into it, how important was it to have something written down that could be distributed and be a rallying cause for leaders and for the common man?
It was critical. It was very, 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 very important. Actually, there were several audiences that the Declaration was aimed at, certainly among them the King and the Parliament, to let them know what their complaints were about. Certainly also among them was allies to say that these people are serious, that they would like to get some help from the international community. But then, of course, you had Washington that was in the middle of recruiting troops and commanding people in the field. And so, and you're asking these people to die, and the issue is, what are they dying for? And then, of course, there was the American population as a whole in terms of having their commitment to this effort of establishing a brand new government. So the audiences that Jefferson needed to speak to in the creation of the Declaration of Independence were diverse and many. And he needed to make it pretty straightforward and simple. And he took some extremely difficult and sometimes topics that whole books are written about and condensed them into, as the book indicates, there's two sections. One is only 8 words long and the other one's only 55 words long. And Jefferson expressed the basic legitimacy of the effort with the 8 words and then expressed what he described as defining the American mind with the other 55.
So how does he go about writing this? Because, and first of all, when I read this, I couldn't believe it. Was he 33 years old when he wrote the Declaration of Independence?
Yeah, it's so sad when people talk about the rich old white guys.
Right.
And Tom Jefferson was what we would define, at least what I would define as a millennial for all practical purposes.
He should have tweeted it is what he should have done. Yeah.
Well, you know, The law of nature and nature's God certainly is less than 140 characters.
Yes.
And he described the legitimate basis for the establishment of the United States in those eight words. He could have done it in a tweet.
And remind everyone what the eight words are that you're talking about.
The law of nature and nature's God, which was because these fellows were in the process of establishing a government that was not going to be run by a king. And the theory also was that they were establishing a government that was going to be governed by the rule of law and not by the rule of men. So it was important to have something that was transcendent, something that was not able to be altered by men, as the very, very top basis of the establishment of this republic.
So walk us through how the writing process goes, because, gosh, I write things every now and then, and I stare at a blank piece of paper, and maybe I write something down, and at the end of the day, there's no consequence, because it's just something for myself or maybe for a few friends to read, let alone an entire new country. So what's going through his head? What's going through his fellow, founding fathers as they had come to be? What happens? How does this document come to be?
He and Adams lay out the basic ideas of what this needs to be over a beer in City Tavern.
So they brainstorm over a beer.
They brainstorm.
So it'd be like me and Esmeralda going to the Billy Goat. Right, yeah. After this, and being like, we got to talk about some ideas we have.
Meeting of the minds.
Yes.
Yes. They brainstorm over a beer in City Tavern, which, by the way, still exists in Philadelphia, and you can go get a beer there to Thomas Jefferson's recipe, to George Washington's recipe.
Wow.
So it's a very, very spooky and interesting place to be, sipping on Jefferson's ale and considering what happened in those rooms.
And I'll be 33 next month, so I should...
There you go, perfect.
Perfect, I'll line it all up perfectly. By the way, I'm thinking, I'm going to be 33, and Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence at that age. Incredible stuff.
Yeah, I only started law school at 33, you know, and so I'm thinking I was a bit of a failure because I only got to law school at 33, and he's already writing the Declaration.
Exactly. So they sit over some beers, they talk general what they want to get accomplished.
What they want to get accomplished, and then they do something that I give away a little bit of a lawyer's secrets.
Okay.
in the course of the book, because the format for the Declaration of Independence was something that would be pulled out of what lawyers would call a form book. If you take a criminal or a civil complaint and lay it side by side with the Declaration of Independence, for all practical purposes, they're the same document.
Really? And what do you mean by that? Is it like, is it top down? It explains the goals and missions right at the top. I mean, what do you mean by?
There's a form. The lawyers have forms for everything, right? Mm-hmm. There's a form for a will, for a deed, any kind of legal document you can think of.
Like legal Mad Libs.
There you go.
Yeah. I was going to say, so they're filling in the blanks.
How did he come up with such an immortal document in such a short period of time? He went to his form book.
Wow.
You know, and for all practical, you could call the Declaration of Independence the United States of America versus King George if you'd like to.
Wow.
You know, because the way it starts out is usually there's a statement of what the issues are. Then there's a statement of identification of the parties. Then there's a statement of the law. Then from the statement of the law, there's the conduct of the defendant is described, and then good lawyers generally go on and say good things about their client at that next point in time. Then there's a signature of the plaintiff, and if you look at the Declaration of Independence and you put it beside a civil lawsuit that gets filed in a court or a criminal complaint, they're the same thing.
Wow.
Jefferson fills in the blanks.
Interesting. Now, that seems easy enough, but he's also got to use language, like we say, to appeal to a lot of audiences and to be that sort of rah-rah factor.
Oh, there's a couple of considerations that go on in that. Typically, these complaints begin with, or at least in those days, began with a clause that was called whereas. You know, you start out with a whereas clause, but that was also the form for a royal decree. And at this particular point in time, they're about to get rid of the king.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't want, and it's going to be read in a public place, public square is going to be read all around the country, and you don't want something that sounds like a royal decree. And so he substituted whereas for obviously a very, very well-known phrase, when in the course of human events. compared to whereas. And so then it goes on and it talks about the king, talks about all the terrible things the king does, and then it talks about all the nice things that the colonists did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of people don't read the entire thing, of course. It's the 55 words that we remember so well. And those were almost pretty much untouched from what Thomas Jefferson had come up with originally, except for One very notable exception.
Originally, before Jefferson was nominated to the committee to draft the Declaration, Ben Franklin had been approached to be the writer. He was one of the premier writers of the day. He had his own political issues with Pennsylvania, but he also took the position that I never write anything that's about to be edited by a public committee. And so Ben Franklin turned down writing the Declaration of Independence. But he was one of the editors, but he only made one small change. The phrase that we hold these truths to be self-evident that start out the 55 words that became the American Creed, Jefferson originally had written, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." Franklin scratched sacred and undeniable and put in self-evident. And that changed. Franklin's contribution to the Declaration is just immeasurable.
Can you talk about the difference between the two and why it does make such a difference between the two? Or is it self-evident and I should have figured it out by myself?
I'd like to think there's some self-evidence right there. However, Franklin didn't indicate sacred and undeniable. Some of it didn't flow as well.
Right.
You know, some of it didn't sound. Some of it, that's a little bit harder to read in a public square than self-evident. However, Franklin said the sacred and undeniable had a different kind of religious overtone to it. And there was certainly an important aspect of the audience that you wanted to make sure that you were inclusive of the potential audience rather than exclusive of an audience, which can bring us back to the law of nature and nature's God. There's a very, very interesting thing about that. So, but we can go back to that at some point.
Yeah, I think sacred and, you know, that to me that says that, again, that has been given to man, the idea that we have this right and to govern ourselves has been given. I think the self-evident is that it comes from within us, that we are born with this sort of, and he goes on to say those sorts of things, that it, as self-evident, it's almost, well, duh. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, in modern Twitter terms, well, duh, of course we should be free, right? What? Of course.
Yeah.
Am I right? Yeah. I think that's what self-evident is. I don't know.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to talk a little bit more about the final touches of writing this document. And then not only its importance in American history, and of course it is hugely important, but then the role it plays across the entire world. So we'll have more on that next on 720 WGN. We got there eventually, Esmeralda.
Yeah.
720 WGN. Nick DiGilio is out this morning enjoying a nice day off. Well earned.
Very.
Man, we've been so packed today, we haven't even talked about Jaws yet, Esmeralda. My favorite 4th of July movie.
Forget it. We have to stop now.
Yeah, we're going to stop talking about the Declaration of Independence. Sorry, David. David Shostakis wrote Creating the Declaration of Independence, a really fascinating book that tells kind of the story of how we came to be, how we get the American Creed. And we left off with Thomas Jefferson drunk at a bar, writing some words down, Benjamin Franklin and rising a few of them. So he writes this long document, and a lot of it does get changed when they bring it back and chat with the whole Second Continental Congress. But those 55 words, for the most part, untouched once it leaves the quill of Thomas Jefferson, right?
The 55 words that start with, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and wind up with consent of the government, governed, were not touched at all by this, with the exception of the self-evident situation that we described in the last segment. The rest of those 55 words were not touched by anybody in the Continental Congress. And frankly, those words, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that the government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed, were what Jefferson considered to be the expression of the American mind, and were what set forward and said changed the world.
Yeah.
Not just the United States, but changed the world. And 10,000 years, nothing had been done like this before, and in the 240 years since, more than 100 countries have come into being with the issuance of a document modeled after the Declaration of Independence.
And we could go on and talk about the entire, obviously, a Revolutionary War and what happens, but I think that's probably a discussion for another day. So the Declaration of Independence, though, really quickly, it's written, it's adopted. How does that work then in terms of the actual signing off? Does he read it aloud and everyone goes, pretty good, all right, good, thumbs up? How does that work? What day does that actually happen? How does that work?
Well, on Richard Henry Lee's resolution for independence ultimately winds up with a 12-0 decision on July the 2nd, which is literally the true day of independence of the United States of America. John Adams wrote a famous letter to Abigail indicating that July the 2nd would forever be celebrated as a day of parties and games and fireworks and barbecues,
right,
and those kinds of things. He wrote that letter on July the 3rd.
Right.
But Adams was a bit incorrect in his prediction.
Although it is my parents' anniversary, so I will say July 2nd does have fireworks for them.
John Adams was thinking about that.
He was. He knew that back in the day. Yeah, so he thinks it's going to be July the 2nd, and that's when what actually happens in the Continental Congress on the 2nd?
On the 2nd, they have a vote for Lee's resolution that he had introduced on June the 7th. And as I mentioned, it was 12-12 zip. New York abstained. New York never did.
Really?
New York never really did get their act together to get their instructions from the legislature, which was driving Adams and a variety of people crazy at the time, because Washington's army was in New York City and the British were sailing toward New York, and they're going, why isn't New York on board with this?
Why weren't they on board with it? A host of reasons, I imagine.
There was a host of internal political reasons going on in the state of New York, or the colony of New York at that moment in time, and so they were a little bit of distressed. And of course, Pennsylvania, we mentioned Dickinson had stormed out the vote, and Franklin voted,
yep,
you're gone. I'm doing this.
I wish we could do that in the state Senate. Because they didn't have enough people to make the budget vote today.
Yeah.
So I wish someone else could have been like, well, he's not here, but he's a yes.
I think he would say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So ultimately it turned out to be 12-0 to adopt Lee's resolution. Then they spent the next 2 days editing Jefferson's draft of the Declaration of Independence.
I bet he loved that.
No, he didn't. He wasn't really thrilled about that, although he was, generally speaking, a quiet guy when it came to speaking. He did say that what they had done was emasculated his declaration.
Okay.
And they actually struck out about 25% of it, including a provision where he had excoriated the king for not allowing them to abolish the international slave trade. Jefferson had some things in there regarding, because Jefferson was quite aware of the incompatibility of the American creed that he had just laid out and the existence of slavery.
But Jefferson was a slave owner himself, right?
He was, in fact, but he had, there's a couple of segments in the book Creating the Declaration of Independence that talk about Jefferson's internal struggles with the understanding of what he was talking about, what he was proposing, and the, in fact, existence of slavery.
A lot of hypocrisy there. And that's, I think, that speaks to the truth about these men, that there were many flaws.
Mm-hmm.
There were flaws, but I don't think that's necessarily fair to provide or judge them by current standards when you consider that, again, the 10,000 years that had existed before, slavery was ubiquitous throughout the world. This was the whole idea of the consent of the governed. Greeks had enslaved Romans. Romans had enslaved Greeks. It was not. They set the standard that put before mankind the idea that no person was in fact better than another person and as of right able to rule over them.
Well, we'll debate that over a beer sometime, David.
Fair
enough. That's a whole another can of worms that we've opened up. Okay, so what happens on the 4th?
On the 4th of July. Ultimately, after the editing process goes through, the Continental Congress adopts Jefferson's declaration in support of Lee's resolution. And a fellow by the name of John Dunlap takes the text of the document, lays it out in what became known as Dunlap broadsheets, and dated them the 4th of July. And so based on Dunlap's printing, and he printed the first couple of hundred copies, that's how we came to celebrate the 4th of July, because Dunlap chose the 4th to date the resolution, or date the declaration.
So was he was just at a shop down the street or something? Is that how they chose him to actually print this off? They just go to the nearest guy?
He was a local Philly printer. He was a local Philly printer involved in a couple of things. How Ben Franklin didn't get the job, I don't know.
Right. Right.
Because Franklin, that was among the things that made Franklin rich. Ben Franklin was really, really rich.
Yeah.
In fact, he put together an endowment for the Philadelphia Library, that public library that they are still earning money from.
Are you kidding?
That they're still earning money from.
Okay, so it gets printed and distributed quickly, I imagine, or as quickly as it could have been in the day.
As quickly as it could have been in the day. We went out by horseback, and within a week, it was up to George Washington in New York, where he read it before the troops.
I imagine, because nowadays you'd just Instagram it. You'd just take a nice little picture and be like,
go ahead.
You'd tweet it. You'd Instagram
it. Facebook
it. Maybe a Snapchat.
Did people get to see it?
Absolutely.
Like, in that, were they kind of giving copies to just the regular folks?
They were giving copies out. They were printing copies. There was 200 originally printed by Dunlap that night, and then those were distributed around Philadelphia, and then there were more copies that were printed and distributed around the country.
Wow.
Man, to be a fly on the wall as that is printed over and over again that night on July the 4th. That is, I mean, that's crazy. Just imagine just being there. What's the mood? I mean, is it celebratory? Is it apprehension? What are these men feeling as this document's being spread?
Apprehension and trepidation. They don't know the outcome. We do.
Right. Spoiler alert, it turns up pretty good.
Yeah.
By the way, it ends up okay.
Yeah,
not to ruin the end.
They did not know the outcome, although it was very effective in obtaining the consent of the governed. Over time, more than 8,000 Americans would, in fact, die in battle over the next 8 years, and more than 200,000 would serve in the Continental Army during the course of time. And so the idea that Jefferson was effective in providing the incentive for people to understand what they were doing is obviously true.
The book is Creating the Declaration of Independence. David Shostakis, thank you so much for joining us, man. We didn't even get to chat about how this document spreads all over the world, but it does inspires revolutions on its own. You'll have to read the book to read more about that. And again, where can people pick it up?
Pick up Creating the Declaration of Independence on Amazon, both in print and Kindle. It's only 3 weeks old, so hopefully people will be looking at it for a long time to come.
It's Cheeto-stained my version of it. I've already got it. Highlighted a lot of it. I'm going to be finishing it up this afternoon for sure. David, thank you so much for coming in early this morning. We really appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
All right, we've got a quick little break, then we'll have news here on 720 WGN. WGN, Nick DiGilio out on this Independence Day. Enjoyed a nice day off, as he should. Esmeralda Leon, who you know very well, is to my right. We are in the Allstate Showcase studio here on the first floor, because Nick's normally on 7.
Yes, he's usually on the 7th.
Right.
We like to be in a cave, essentially.
I like to be in a fishbowl. Nick likes to be in a cave.
Yeah. Although it's a beautiful view because you get to look from a top.
Right.
But no one's banging on the window.
Honestly, the reason I do it, and I'm sure it's the exact same setup, is and you can already hear, listeners, how poorly I run this board. It's the only one I know how to run that I've been taught on, so I'm always afraid to do things a little bit differently. Okay, so we're going to shift gears. Man, we have been zigging and zagging. We started with smoking on airplanes and how much that's changed. Then we talk about the history of 1776. But Independence Day also, of course, has the connotations of the 4th of July. But we're going to take a little interesting spin on independence in your life, in your relationship life, and how that can be a little interesting to navigate. I imagine many of our listeners out there are married and have been for a long time, and congratulations to you with kids and grandkids. But I know a lot of listeners out there maybe are single. They've always been single, or they're recently divorced or something along those lines. So to help and chat through relationships here on this 4th of July is Samantha Jane here and her team. They rescue professional singles with incredible lives who are looking for love. Samantha, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good morning.
So, Samantha, you're joining us from Australia, right? What day and time is it there? I can never figure it out.
It is 7.09 p.m. on Tuesday.
July the 4th.
July the 4th.
Okay.
So it's, same day.
I don't know why I'm so fascinated by that, but I am. I never quite remember where the international date line falls. So you are a life coach, an accredited dating coach, and a human behavioral expert. You really love the science of the matchmaking between two people.
I do, because it's a science. I mean, love is all about science and attraction and chemistry. So I incorporate a lot of human behavior with my matching, and that's how I help people move forward, especially when it comes to personality types and making relationships last.
We talked a lot about history in the last segment in terms of American history. I imagine some people out there might say, what exactly do we need dating coaches for? We've been matching people together for years, and the human species has gone on with what happens when you match two people together. Is it that things are more complicated now? Have we been doing things not efficiently for the last couple thousand years? Or is it that, you know, again, things are just different now, and it always helps to get some help along the way?
I'm finding there is a big thing happening out there called the paradox of dating. So we have more choice than ever. There's online dating, there's dating apps, there's social groups, there's matchmakers. So what's happening is there's an overwhelming amount of choice. And with that overwhelming amount of choice, people are just not getting anywhere. They're making the same mistakes. They're swiping, moving on to the next best thing, not giving anyone a chance. And there's this thing where they're looking, thinking, oh, the grass is always greener. I'll find someone better and better. And then before they know it, they've been single for years. And then they become frustrated, and then it affects their confidence. And then they call me. That's my help.
Well, now, do you even recommend these sites, the OkCupids and the Tinders? Okay. Do you recommend people use them, or is it kind of you should stay off?
Definitely. No, they're a brilliant way to meet people. Statistics have found since 2015, online dating jumped from 2010 to 2015 by 50%. So it went from 25% up to 50%. So everyone is on it. Everyone is online dating. So if you're not in it, you're not going to find that potential person. But you need to be very strategic about this. So you need to look at what your needs are, what your goals are, who are you looking for, and give everyone a chance. Like, give them, you know, go out with someone that you kind of like at least three times before you actually discard them.
Yeah, I think we look for flaws so quickly. I think that that's what you mentioned is very true. By the way, I want to open this up to everyone listening as well, 312-981-7200. Whether you are in a happy relationship and has been forever, maybe you've got some advice out there and you and Samantha can jive about that. Or if you're looking for questions, if you're new to the single life or you've been single for a long time and need a little help, we have Samantha on the line. We might as well utilize her wherever we can. You okay with that, Samantha? People got some questions?
Yeah, love to chat. Absolutely.
So, you know, every single day it seems like there's a new article about dating, about don't say this or make sure you do this. You know, we're all into listicles right now and BuzzFeed's article, and they, of course, have their place. Do you think that there's a point where we do overthink it a little bit?
Absolutely. And see, when you're overthinking things, that's when fear kicks in and you're in your head as opposed to your heart. So when you're in your heart space, you just have a general conversation. You talk about hobbies and interests, and you talk about your dream. When you're in your head, that's when you can go into analysis paralysis, where your brain is ticking over, but the words aren't coming out, and that is a huge chemistry killer. And that can actually lead to people drinking too much on dates because of their nerves or very bad experiences. Yeah, definitely overthinking.
I drink too much on dates, but I've been in a relationship for 5 years, and that's a point of contention between us.
He's used to it right now.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the single life. All right, so a lot of our listeners, I imagine a lot of our listeners, we have millennial listeners, of course, younger people who love to listen. But what advice would you have for someone that has been through maybe a marriage already, someone who's in their 40s or 50s or 60s, who might be a little apprehensive about dating apps, who might think that, you know, there's no successes that come from that? What advice do you give to someone who might be trying out this technology for the first time, but they're not new to love by any stretch of the imagination?
What I recommend to somebody who's dating for the second time round is understand that there are millions of people in your position. You are not alone. So know that you're probably going to meet someone in a very similar position to you. And the most important thing is, look, let the past be the past. Learn from your experiences and focus on what you want. And when you are out there dating, don't talk about your ex. Don't talk too much about your children. This is about you. This is an opportunity to go and find the love of your life and make this last.
That's interesting. Don't talk about your children. I think you're not saying don't necessarily hide the fact that you have children, of course. But don't spend the time talking about how much you love them. Talk about the things that you love about yourself, I guess.
That's right. Like, have your own identity. So maybe this is time. Maybe you have to look at why your relationship failed. Sometimes it's completely out of your control, but other times you may have just lost yourself, and this is a beautiful time to rediscover your confidence, to go and do the things that you've loved and always wanted to do. Take up hobbies, interests, become an interesting person, and be that person that you want to meet, that you want to date. Think to yourself, would I want to meet me if I was out there and become that person? And that is so attractive that you'll be inundated with men or women, whoever you're looking for.
Or both, you know, that's fine. It's 2017. All right, so Samantha, stay with us, please, if you don't mind, because it's Independence Day. We've already covered the American part. We're talking to all those independent singles out there. We want everyone to end this show. We want to hook some people up. Samantha's going to stay with us here on the line. We're going to have some more with Esmeralda and John filling in for Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. WGN, John Hanson and Esmeralda Leon in for Nick DiGilio. It's been a fun Independence Day morning, getting the history of the Declaration of Independence, talking about smoking on airplanes, and now we're trying to hook you up. That's what we're trying to do, and we have Samantha Jane, who is a relationship expert, a certified life coach, a dating coach, a human behavioral expert, and Samantha, Esmeralda's got a lot of... Now, neither of us are single. I wish...
We're not single.
For the sake of the argument, I wish we had been single here to talk today.
Well, we could arrange
we
that.
We could arrange that, right. We could send a few quick text messages out. And boom, we could talk. But we both remember our single lives, and you never know, we might be again. So, Esmeralda, what do you got for us?
So, I have just a question about the dating apps. When I was on them, there was always the moments of where you wouldn't even meet people. You would just connect with people, think things were good, and then they would disappear. Or you would just think everyone's a dud. So how do you get out of that slump? When everything on the apps, just it feels like everything is wrong and there is no one to find.
Yes, that happens very often. Actually, ghosting, when people disappear, that tends to be something called ghosting. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very common. And that's because people are in that state of play. It's like, oh, there's so many other options. People, you know, their dating game used to be, I'll wait 3 days before I contact that person. But if you wait 3 days, they're probably snapped up. So if you're in a position where you're really frustrated with, oh, there's no one out there, take a break and refresh. Just take some time out for you and rethink you and reset your profile, maybe change your photos around and start to think about, are you looking for somebody who is just that physical person that's showing all the apps, or are you looking for something more? And you'll find, taking a break, going back, you'll find some golden gems amongst the people, because it does work.
Samantha, I got to ask, because when I was on OkCupid before Brett and I met, and one thing I noticed is that people seem to, and I'm sure this is still the case, endlessly want to talk back and forth electronically through the app or through online. I imagine that your advice would be, and something that I found worked, is look, we made a connection quickly. We talked a few lines back and forth. Clearly, we have a few things in common. We can tell that via the app or whatever the site you're using. Let's get coffee, and the quicker the better.
Definitely. definitely. Otherwise, if you keep going back and forth, it fizzles out. So it's best, look, you're both interested, you've got each other's details, make plans, because if you talk too much, it kills the chemistry.
Well, you're absolutely right. Well, then, I think that, but Samantha, I think that talks to your earlier point, is that we're putting our guards up so quickly that even in that texting back and forth, the talking through the app, you're already looking for flaws. So it's like, gosh, just man, maybe someone says one little thing over text and it's interpreted the wrong way. Just go out with the damn person, and then maybe you'll find that you just like them, and the little thing they said is no big deal.
Yeah.
I know. We're talking about humans, and we need to connect with each other. And look, it takes our brains know when we first meet that person, it takes 3 minutes to connect with that person, to get in front of each other. Otherwise, you'll end up staying where you are, and that's where you go back into the analysis paralysis. You keep swiping, you keep looking for the next best thing, and no one, you end up with no one. So definitely make that. Just take action.
You mentioned ghosting. What are some other pitfalls that you see of the online dating that people should watch out for? I know, what do they call it? Like benching is another one?
Yeah, benching. That's where people are constantly looking for that next best thing, thinking, oh, there's someone better out there. And that's a really dangerous habit. I actually know someone who's been single for over 10 years because she keeps looking for somebody who just doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And that keeps changing. So the best thing is to just take action, make it happen. You've got people who are looking for serious relationships when they're online and people who aren't. So
I guess, understanding those expectations going in is pretty important.
Well, and once you are talking with someone, is there anything that, like you said, you have that friend who's been single for so long. Is there things that you kind of just have to give up? Or, because like you said, you can't find the perfect person. What would be something that maybe you should kind of lay off? Like, don't think about that too much.
Yeah, look, some people are really specific. Like, don't worry about the suburb where they live. And, I mean, that's something that can be adjusted. Mm-hmm. Sometimes women are really stuck on height. Like, they want somebody...
Yeah, no, I've heard that a lot.
Size, and, you know, that eliminates a lot of really fantastic men. Just look at sometimes people that... When you're too specific about career or hair color... Mm-hmm. The car they drive, it just closes the gap and closes so many opportunities. So just have an open heart. Instead, focus on what are your core values? I mean, is it family? Do you like fitness? I mean, what are your common interests? And focus on those common interests. And is this person somebody that is, you know, has a very similar lifestyle? Are you both drinkers? Do you like both going out a lot, or do you prefer a healthy lifestyle? And ultimately, birds of a feather flock together. So you want to be with somebody who's just going to get you, and you'll bring out the best in each other.
Samantha, I got to ask, because I imagine a lot of people are listening. I mentioned this off the top. They're of my parents or grandparents' generation, and they say, we met at the soda fountain, and she was the first person I ever laid my eyes on, and we've been married for 70 years. Like, you hear these stories all the time. And, of course, things have changed so much generationally from where they were. But maybe there are some things that those generations did right that we can learn from. Is there anything you can point to, or was it just the matter of they didn't get around enough?
No, absolutely. I mean, they're committed to each other, and all relationships take work. They go through different cycles and stages. Everyone in a relationship will go through a phase of where you have a teething problem, where you'll be thinking, oh my gosh, we're arguing so much right now. We are growing apart. But when you find that is happening, instead of giving up, look at what's actually happening. Go back and date that person. Be nice to them. Be kind to yourself. Maybe take that time out for you and take that time out from each other and bring back the romance. Because you'll find that people who have had relationships for 70 years, they have had their ups and they have had their downs, but they've made that commitment to be with each other.
We do these love stories on the television station that I'm on, WCIU, the huge, quick little shout out. And we do these love stories where people that have been married for so long. And what I glean from all of it always is that they obviously love each other. They have this look when they look at each other, this knowing look. But they aren't necessarily all so glowing about it all the time. It's not such a bragging thing. And I think in this day of social media, man, every relationship looks like the greatest thing on earth. And I think that is has really clouded who we are, and that we think that everyone is in these perfect relationships, when the reality is, if it seems too perfect on Facebook, it's probably not that good.
Absolutely. Facebook is so unrealistic. I mean, no one's going to put their argument Ideally, most people don't put their arguments on there.
Maybe we should encourage that more, because I always roll my eyes when people are like, me and the hubby are fighting, he's such a jerk today. I roll my eyes at it. But maybe that's a more honest look at it. Maybe that at least gives us an actual glimpse into who they are.
Yeah, that's right. Being a bit more realistic. Yeah.
But yeah.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, social media, look, there are pros and cons of it. I mean, the positives are that you can actually maintain a really close connection with your partner and your network, and you can nurture the relationship by positive interactions, like posting positive photos, declaring your love and commitment, and that can help the relationship flourish. On the other side, people don't like to see that too much. Mm-hmm. And if you tend to be a jealous couple, it can... if it's overused, it can really cause some real tension in that relationship.
All right, Samantha Jane. Yeah, hopefully your words of advice, and I think that, like, hearing from you and just hearing about this behavior sort of thing, and if nothing else, people then can reflect and say, yeah, this has happened to me, but as you say it, it happens to everybody, these sorts of things. So, Samantha, where can people find out more information about your services, or just to read a little bit more of what you do?
You can find me on SamanthaJane.com.au, so it's SamanthaJane with a Y, .com.au.
All right, Samantha, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank
and
you.
Whatever day it is, whatever time it is, you're always welcome to call here on 720 WGN, okay?
Thanks, guys.
Absolutely.
It's been great.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to take a really quick commercial break, and then we'll have the news here on 720 WGN. Sorry, I just turned on your mic, Esmeralda.
Man, I'm talking to you.
I know.
Off
I
of the air.
I didn't mean to hit that. 720 WGN, John Hanson, and Esmeralda Leon filling in for Nick DiGilio. You all know Esmeralda, of course.
Yeah. Hopefully. All know John Hanson.
Well, no,
Come on.
A lot of people don't. We fill in a lot of times on the weekend. But this is normally when I'm listening to you and Nick.
Mm-hmm.
This is when I'm usually sitting in my car outside of WCIU, putting on my makeup. In the car, so I can listen to WGN.
Wait a minute,
what?
So you put your makeup on in the car.
So I get to work kind of early, but I love the peace and quiet of my own vehicle before I go into work.
Okay.
So yeah, I put
peace and quiet aside from.
Besides
and us.
You two,
yes,
bonkers talking back and forth, usually playing some
about the
game
dumbest thing.
Or,
yeah, we're,
or the cats
games.
Warming up, yeah. The singing. I love every second of you. I seriously do. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners out there, I'm sure a lot of listeners right now are like, who is this guy? Where is Nick? I feel the same way when someone fills in for Nick. I love you guys. I love listening to you every single morning and really appreciate all that you do. But, so I sit in the car. And I kind of read through some of the stories of the day. Obviously, I hear Vic's reports, so I'm caught up on all the news. And then I put on my makeup on my little, my rear view mirror and the little mirror that comes down.
I put on my makeup.
Right. Before I put on, that's makeup. All right.
Gonna say a little prayer for you.
Say a lot of prayers for us. We got another 23 minutes of this show. Everyone get on through it. 312-981-7200 is the talk and text line. So, Esmeralda, it is the 4th of July, a wonderful day. We talked earlier about people's traditions, what the difficulties are of traveling around. But the one tradition that I have with a couple friends is I watch the quintessential 4th of July movie, Jaws, which I feel like is... the best 4th of July movie out there. It takes place, of course, along the 4th of July weekend. There's, of course, Independence Day. There's other movies out there. But to me, I think Jaws is that quintessential summer blockbuster horror film that stands the test of time. We used to watch it at my grandparents' house on Betamax. They had a Betamax player.
Dang.
And we wore down the tape on that thing. My parents wouldn't let us watch Jaws as young kids, so we'd watch it at grandma's house, of course.
So she'd have to deal with the nightmares.
Right. She'd make a screwdriver for herself at 7 in the morning and just say, go ahead and watch Jaws, kids.
Real nice. And well, they had a pool? Did they have a pool?
They had a pool.
Oh,
they did.
Come on.
Once, I love my grandparents both. My grandfather actually just passed away a couple months ago now. Mm-hmm. But my grandma, this is just such a weird aside story. You know, they were a product of the 1920s and the 1930s. They were partiers. My grandfather was a World War II veteran. They liked to have some cocktails. I'll never forget sitting around at breakfast one time at grandma's. My parents let us go to grandma and grandpa's for like 2 weeks of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget taking a sip of grandma's drink one time, orange juice. Because I had orange juice, she had orange juice. I accidentally took a sip of the wrong cup, and I think I either spit it out or just, blah. And she was like, never, never take any of grandma's drink. Because it
grandma's
was 7
juice.
In the morning, and they were having, of course, she was having a screwdriver.
Oh,
at
7 great.
In the morning, and grandpa would have his scotch. And
at 7 in the morning?
I don't know what time he started drinking, but at some point. And then they would just be like, all right, go play in the pool, kids.
After watching Jaws,
there's no it sharks was a different time. They were probably sloshed by about 1 or 2 p.m., taking care of three kids and then my cousins in a pool. And no one ever thought anything of it. Like, this was totally fine behavior.
Now, wait, were you scared?
No.
Were you scared of Jaws?
Of grandma?
No, of Jaws. That's why I asked about the pool, just because people were frightened when that movie came out.
Yeah, that movie would scare me, but we would watch it through our fingertips and kind of mm-hmm. peek on through.
But did you believe there was a shark?
Like, in the pool sometimes, yeah. Especially when my older brother told me there was, and he would play the character of Jaws and grab our feet and pull us underwater. But that was like the fun part about summer. Those 2 weeks at grandma's were the best. We watched Jaws and Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. What else did they have on Betamax? Eventually they got, this was later on, but they got Clear and Present Danger with Harrison Ford, and we watched that over and over and over again.
Nothing says holidays right. like Clear and Present Danger.
This is all a build-up because I know you, Esmeralda, and I know mm-hmm. by listening to you and Nick
yeah.
that there are some movies you are able to jive back and forth on, and they are usually the strangest ones out there. But for some of the classics, man, you have not seen them, and I'm blown away by the fact that you've never seen Jaws.
I haven't seen Jaws. I've seen bits and pieces, but I've never seen it in its entirety. I mean, I know the big things, you know.
Which are what?
Boat.
There's a boat?
The boat scene. Yeah, there's a boat.
Okay.
There's
what else
water,
do you know? There's
I think.
Water,
people
yeah.
swim, uh-huh. right? No, but there's, you know, there's the, when they're on the boat, and then the Jaws, like, pretty much eats half of the boat.
Right. This is the official IMDb
someone.
Review, Esmeralda style. Yeah, he does.
I think we need a bigger boat.
Yep.
Isn't that a line?
That is
too?
A line. It was an improvised line that they eventually kept.
Dreyfus is in it.
Dreyfus is in it. Yeah, he plays Hoopa. Hoopa.
Oh, because they got. All right, I see.
What? I don't. Yeah.
No, they got the accent. Hoopa.
Hoopa. Well, that was Quince. I was doing the voice of Quince.
Oh, okay.
Hoopa drives the boat, Chief. So there's just so many wonderful lines, and I just can't believe you haven't seen it. So I put on Twitter. My Twitter name is John, J-O-N, the Cubs fan, which mm-hmm. I'm still slightly embarrassed about. Not that I'm a Cubs fan, but that's my Twitter. And I said, have you ever seen the movie Jaws? I put this out last night. The options were yes, of course, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I'm the worst because I cannot imagine people not watching Jaws. That seems like insane to me. But I was surprised. It was 75-25. 75% of people have seen Jaws, mm-hmm. and 25 people haven't. So you've got plenty of people out there.
Okay, good. Well, you know what it is? And honestly, this is why I haven't seen a lot of the classics, because they're not around. You can't find a lot. Sometimes you can't find them, or
I don't think it's on Netflix, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's usually where people go. They go to Netflix.
Mm-hmm. There's no more blockbusters.
Right.
I mean, there are a few, I'm sure, but
I mean, you can get Redbox, but I don't think they have
they
lot
have Jaws
of those classics.
Redbox.
Yeah, exactly.
It is interesting.
It kind of stinks that you can't, sometimes you just can't find it.
It is interesting that in this day and age, we feel like everything's at our fingertips, mm-hmm. but some of the, like, my roommate and I were trying to watch Will and Grace, which, of course, is not that old. It's from the late 90s, and it's nowhere. We can't find it.
Yeah.
And we don't even have a DVD player anymore. We haven't. I think it's buried in my closet.
Oh, boy.
I'm not going to go get the box set of DVDs.
Right,
it's not streaming. So I'm like, well, never mind. I guess I'm not watching Will and Grace.
Exactly. And you just got to wait.
That's interesting that we think that everything's so accessible these days.
Yeah, it's behind
but
a
so
pay,
many classics.
A paywall.
And so many classics also, I remember they, and I'm sure that Jaws is on somewhere today. I'm sure it's on AMC or something like that. But as our TV viewing habits change as well, where we used to go to, you know, the Saturday night TV movie special. I mean, that's mm-hmm. Wizard of Oz. I mean, it was popular in its release in 1939, but the reason why it becomes so popular later on is its rebroadcast. And when you only had four channels, that was one of the ones you watched. You watched Wizard of Oz every year in the 50s when they'd replay it. Same with Jaws when you had limited options. We almost have so many options now.
Yeah.
And so many people are cutting cords. They get classic movies. Are getting a little bit lost.
Right. And a lot of the movies I have seen are because they kept playing them over and over again on Comedy Central and TBS. That's why, and Nick makes fun of me, I've seen the Cheech and Chong movie, Corsican Brothers, because it kept playing on Comedy Central.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, that's the one I know. I haven't seen Up in Smoke. They don't play Up in Smoke on Comedy Central.
This is an interesting discussion about the movies that you, and I think we've done this before with Blake Stubbs, that movies that people say you have to see and that you haven't. And we got a text just right now. A 61-year-old says, I'm 61, never seen It's a Wonderful Life.
I haven't either.
And neither have I.
Although they do rebroadcast it all the time, but I'm just kind of like.
I know. That movie has never, for whatever reason, never sat down and watched the whole thing.
I'm a Christmas story.
So I want to open this up for the last 15 minutes. 312-981-7200. Send us a text if there's a movie that everyone yells at you when you've never seen it. Or your favorite Independence Day movie.
What movie do you want to yell at us about?
But yeah, what movie do you want? Yeah, right. Oh, thank gosh. Okay, I just got a text about where I can watch Will and Grace. Not streaming. It's on Wii. That's apparently a station
now.
But that's
a cable.
I have cable.
Oh, okay. It's Women's Network.
I don't know if I have Wii.
Women's, you should.
We'll find out.
Basic cable.
We will find out after the break here on 720 WGN. Man, best for last. Nice bumping. I love Gorillaz. Because they're a nice job, by the way, today. You having fun this morning?
I am. I'm having a lot of fun. Thanks, guys.
Is your second time producing on your own here?
This is like my first time doing like all on my own. Last time I was with an engineer helping me out. So.
Oh, well, okay.
Well, there you go.
A round of applause for Kassara.
Thank you.
And here I am, the one missing the weather and the traffic. And then each time, Kassara politely gives me the look, and I'm like, oh, okay, I messed that up. Okay, yes. So I'm going to blame the producer for getting to me before them, giving me the afterlook. Well, nice job, Kassara, and we'll be talking with you soon, I'm sure, anytime you want to chime in, of course. Is there, you said there's a movie that everyone gets on you for never having seen, right?
Yeah, the Titanic.
Titanic.
I've never seen it, like, in its entirety.
Okay. I haven't either, but I only because I protest, because I loved Leonardo DiCaprio at that point when it came out, and everyone was just, like, all about that movie, and I was like, no, I liked him before this movie.
You were a DiCaprio hipster? And that's why you wouldn't go see one of the best movies he was ever in?
I like him in Romeo and Juliet, not this Titanic you all love.
You didn't go see it out of spite for the actor that you loved.
Mm-hmm. And the hatred of all the fans that jumped on the Titanic.
Well, they jumped on, but boy, they didn't stay on for long because that thing sank. Spoiler alert. Doesn't end well. The Declaration of Independence, that worked out well.
Yes.
Titanic not so hot. It's a great movie. It's a little long. And up until the iceberg hits, it's an awesome movie. And then, up until the iceberg, they hit the iceberg. The iceberg does not hit them. It doesn't go out of its way. It doesn't say,
is it like Jaws? The iceberg is da-da-da-da.
Oh, there's a ship. Here's what I gotta do. I'm an iceberg. Gotta sink it. You should check it out, though. It's really good. Give yourself an entire afternoon to watch it, though.
An entire afternoon.
It's long.
Right.
Yeah.
And bring the Kleenex, too, because it is sad.
Oh, that, you know what? That, too, about movies, because if you catch them on, like, TBS and stuff, one, they're edited. Two, they take 20 million years because they go through all the commercials.
All the commercials.
Yeah. No time for that.
Right.
Yeah, no, definitely no time.
Ain't nobody got time for commercials.
Exactly.
847 chimes in, I've never took the time to watch any of the Godfather movies, and at this point, I don't care to. See, I was with you in the first half, but why... At this point, do you not care to? I guess there comes a point where if you haven't seen it, it's almost a stubbornness.
Yeah.
That you don't want to just now so many people have said, oh my God, you have to see it, then it becomes an act of defiance not to see it.
No, completely.
I kind of agree with that. At first I was put off by that, but you're absolutely right, The Godfather.
Yeah.
Rich in Florida's never seen Gone with the Wind.
I haven't either. That movie is long.
Never saw it.
All right,
it's
so that's three
long,
for the week.
Though.
That's a long one.
No, thanks. I get kind of angry when it's 2 hours. I'm like, oh, 2 hours.
But these are masterpieces. You can't give them an extra 20 minutes. It's not like it's 2 hours or 4 hours. It's like 2.5 hours. It's only an extra 30 minutes.
Mm-mm.
No?
Can't they just quick? Come on. Give me the liner notes on these movies and then...
Like Spark Notes for movies.
Exactly,
yeah, exactly,
please.
There is an app out there, I think, that if you go to you start it when the movie starts, if you're going to see a film that's in theaters, and if you have to run to the bathroom, it tells you what you missed in the time that you were
in the
restroom.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't go to the bathroom. I just don't want to sit there the entire time.
That's a good point. That's fair.
Why go to the bathroom? I'm not going to go at all.
Yeah, exactly. Right. No, exactly. I give you 2 hours to impress me, movie. The 219 says I should try a local library to find classic movies. That's a good point.
Yeah, but then again, you need a DVD player.
That's
or a
good,
tape player.
That's true.
Or a beta.
Right. So if I had a Betamax,
or those big discs.
I should ask my dad. Maybe I'll call him after this. My grandfather passed away in December. They're going through the house now because obviously my grandmother passed away about 10 years before that.
Betamax?
And I want to know if they have the Betamax. That wasn't one of the items that I was asked if I wanted to keep.
A Betamax?
I have a nightstand. Mm-hmm. My brother got a giant shark tooth that my grandpa had.
So
my grandpa
Jaws's
was a big.
Shark tooth.
It wasn't Jaws's, but my grandpa. This is insane. But he had a giant shark tooth, and then he had a gold necklace put around it.
Oh, come on.
I mean, my grandpa
that
was just
awesome.
That quintessential. Yes, I know. So my brother got it for...
Would he wear it with that, like his shirt kind of
yes.
open?
Yes, he would wear it with his shirt open.
Come on, that's
little
great.
Little hair on his chest.
Oh,
yeah.
I love it.
He was a real man. He jumped from airplanes in the war. And, yeah, I mean, he was a serious guy. And,
man.
He let us watch Jaws and...
And
now that you say
necklaces.
That... Man, this is all coming together as I recollect my childhood. He had the shark tooth on his chest. He had the Jaws, like the actual Jaws of a shark, over the television, like hanging on
oh
the wall.
Gosh.
No wonder why we had a fascination with this. It was like an interactive experience seeing Jaws. We had shark teeth on my grandpa. We had Jaws on the wall.
Now.
Yeah, it all really came together. Really interactive experience that grandpa provided us watching Jaws. The 773 says, have never seen E.T. and has no interest.
I haven't either.
I've seen E.T., but that's one of those ones I've seen in parts. It's been on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen bits and pieces of it.
Yeah.
Never seen it. In its entirety. The point of what you have, everyone has one of these. Like,
right.
And I don't know why we have such vitriol for people where we react so suddenly when everyone's got one.
Right?
Or two or three, except for Blake Stubbs and probably Nick.
Right.
Nick's
seen
everything
and anything and knows all the directors.
Exactly. 312-981-7200. Is there a movie out there that everyone yells at you for not seeing? And if there's an Independence, I don't know of many other Independence Day films. You know, like Christmas has those... So many. Independence Day itself.
The movies.
The aliens,
the three movies, right?
No, there's two or three.
Right?
I think it's two now.
Just two?
It took a long time between making the first and the second one, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, I don't know.
There's Born on the 4th of July. Or is that a... Yeah,
with Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that one.
I have not either.
Yeah. So there's a lot of them out there, but through into 91-7200. Hey, before Dave Plyer comes in to start his show... There's an article about U.S. cities that you are pronouncing completely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I find this article fascinating as we plow through a few of these before we wrap up. The only thing I don't like about this article is it doesn't give us the correct one all the time.
Oh, wait. Well, I can keep talking.
Right. Okay. So you're going to find it out.
Yeah.
So we start with Lafayette, and it says that's not how you pronounce it. And I don't know how you would say Lafayette besides Lafayette. But apparently that's...
Okay, well, I will tell you.
Apparently there's a Louisiana pronunciation that is different. So you're going to look that one up?
So it's Lafayette.
Lafayette.
Yes.
Okay. I wonder if the Indiana one is just Lafayette, or whether it's just Louisiana.
Or we've been saying that one wrong, too.
No, it's Indiana. It's definitely just Lafayette. There's nothing
fancy
about it.
It's West Lafayette, Lafayette,
It's Indiana. There's
I live on the border. I can tell you that right now. It's okay.
Just Indiana, trust me. It's not Boise.
It's Boise.
Boise. Okay.
Yeah, not Z, Boise.
Who says Helena for Montana? I don't know of anyone that says
Helena.
It's not Helena. It's Helena.
Helena, yeah.
In Pennsylvania, there's a town, Wilkes-Barre. That's how I've always looked
at it. It's Wilkes-Barre.
Wilkes-Barre. Okay, look at this. La Jolla? I think that's a pretty easy one. I don't think anyone calls it La Jolla.
No, it's La Jolla.
Wow.
Which means so it's not jar.
Interesting.
Means or jar, like a jar. Yeah, like a...
Thanks for that explanation.
Like a pitcher, like okay. A big, giant jar.
It's obviously not Spokane. It's Spokane, Washington. The one that out there, the Kentucky one. How do you say that city? Not the capital, not Lexington. Starts with Lewis, but it's not Lewis. How do you say that one?
No, I know this one because I've been reprimanded.
All right.
Louisville.
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 You just kind of roll it. Louisville.
Louisville, Dave Plyer.
Bourbonnais, apparently a texter says, is pronounced Bourbon-us.
No.
Is that correct, Dave? Why
I think someone just tricking us.
This is going to sound kind of silly, but there was a Bozo Lost episode that, like, Dean Richards introduced a couple of years ago, and Mr. Ned said they pulled the name out of the big drum, and he called it Bourbon-us.
Oh, no.
And there was an argument between Bozo and Ned about really what it was called.
Were they live on the show?
Yes.
Yeah, I think 224 is...
They argued about...
Yeah. Yeah, pretty sad.
I would love to see Bozo arguing with anyone about any subject.
Yeah.
Besides of which bucket you missed out on or something along those lines.
But it's kind of like all these words you're talking about, like Nolens.
Right.
It's not really New Orleans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sound very white saying New Orleans.
Right.
You know? Although my favorite is in Massachusetts, starts with a W, and it's pronounced for real, and I don't get it, Worcester.
Yeah, Worcester. Yeah.
Worcester.
I lived in New York for a while.
But it's W-O-R-C-E-S-T-E-R.
It's a whole different vernacular out there, isn't it? Yeah.
I've heard, I have a friend from Massachusetts, and he would say it, and I was just like, oh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, you sound really good saying that. And he's like, Worcester. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
By the way, the Bourbon-us person is doubling down. He says, for someone that grew up there, yes, they say that cannot be correct.
Okay. So who would have sided with him? Bozo or?
Bozo said it was Bourbonnais.
Oh, okay.
And Ned said it was Bourbon-us, and he got pretty
Ned
pissed about
it.
Wait, so
it's Bourbonnais, right?
I don't
the
know.
The jury's out. Episode.
Yeah,
well,
jury's
Ned
out.
Ned and 224 are saying it's Bourbon-us.
See, this one would blow my mind.
It would be,
because I go up and down, and you do too, up in Interstate 57. How many countless times you go through Kankakee and
Bourbonnais? Oh, yeah.
The Bears, where do they practice?
Bourbon-us.
No, they don't. It's Bourbonnais.
Yeah, if you or anybody report from there, it's Bourbonnais.
You need to get a Bourbon-us expert.
Why is this just coming to my knowledge right now that it is not, or potentially not?
Yeah. And Bozo involved.
They say that the Bears made it fancy. So
is that really?
Is about the only thing. And 773 says Norfolk is always pronounced incorrectly. Did I say it
Norfolk.
Right?
Norfolk.
What was it?
Oh, excuse me?
Wait, what part? Yeah.
Norfolk.
Okay. Calm down, Dave Plyer. It's 5 a.m. Well, I know you.